Surly ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will be joining us. Ryan Grimm a little bit later. Also on the program, Republican spiraling sends us hurtling towards a government shutdown. This as Trump's oligarchy takes over and Elon Musk endorses a near neo-Nazi party in German elections. Starbucks workers in three West Coast cities go on strike. Amazon Teamsters continue their strike, their five-day strike on day two now. And a day after the Fed rate cuts, key inflation measure rises less than expected. Biden administration's education department wiping student loans for another 55,000 people. Matt Gaetz, remember him? Well, yeah. He threatens to expose lawmakers' harassment settlements if his ethics report gets released.
Oh, the Madison Cawthorn route going down.
And I would say, yes, please, all of it. And more. Release all the documents. Trump puts his $4 billion worth of shares of his media company in a trust operated by his son.
Ah, well, I'm sure he'll just completely have no connection to that going forward.
A new report, U.S. has twice as many troops in Syria as previously reported.
Oy.
Which means that we probably have three times as many troops as previously reported in Syria. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. It is
Casual Friday and the last live Casual Friday of the year.
That's correct. This is our final live show. I should just qualify that by saying it's not inconceivable that Emma or I will jump on the YouTube stream. Yeah, I guess it's pretty inconceivable to Emma. But it's possible. It's not inconceivable. One can conceive of it.
Yeah.
Highly unlikely.
Right.
But, you know, I'll have reason to want to at times to jump on.
To rant?
Yeah.
I mean, we'll see if something like breaks in the coming weeks. But last time we had one of those emergency live stream things was when Biden dropped out, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
Remember those days?
I do remember those days. We have some great best ofs. Do we still have time for any YouTube best ofs things? Okay. We do have, if you still have some YouTube selections of best ofs, send those to us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put into the subject line best ofs. And Matt will drop those in as a little, what do they call them? Easter
goodies.
Eggs?
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
No, they won't be as hidden as Easter eggs. They'll just be right at the end of the episode.
Well, you won't know they're there until you hear them.
It's like dessert.
Yep. I don't know if we have any other house cleaning before then. Do we have anybody in the waiting room yet?
Not quite. Okay. Yeah. We're working around. I think Representative Ocasio-Cortez's pretty hectic schedule as the government shutdown could, you know, the government funding deadline is today. Tonight.
And why don't you just let us know the most recent report of what we're hearing about the potential for a legislation?
Right. So I think, like, basically, as of what Jake Sherman of Punchbowl is reporting so far, that the there's going to be multiple votes, basically, that they're splitting up the continuing resolution into three parts. One that is the continuing resolution to keep the government funded through March. That is the update that we have so far. And parts of the farm bill that were at issue, I think, with the Republicans. And then disaster relief, which will likely fail because Democrats want that. And then after that, they will also vote on an agricultural, the other agricultural piece.
All right. So there it is. We've got, I think we got another 5 minutes. Apparently they've got to download Chrome.
Oh.
So, no, I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. It's only compatible with Chrome, I guess.
Let's, in that case, let's, I saw the text, Bradley. Let's listen to Representative Mike Lawler. This is a guy from New York's 17th district. This is the guy who beat Mondaire Jones for the 17th. And that whole sort of like corridor there is has been a mess for Democrats now. And
we have someone in the waiting room, just so you know. Okay.
Yeah. Do we have somebody?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My bad.
Okay. So here is Mike Lawler on CNN talking to Caitlin Collins.
I will always do what I think is right, which is why, to me, the right answer here was to keep the government funded, and why I find it so jarring that every single Democrat except two voted to shut the government down. Not because they didn't agree.
House Republicans.
Not because they didn't. Yeah,
Caitlin. One sitting right here.
Caitlin.
Totally different reasons.
But you still voted the same way.
Yeah, Caitlin, here's what I think you're missing.
And the 38 House Republicans voted against
this. Caitlin, here's what you're missing.
You're counting
right.
on Democrats.
And 197 Democrats voted against it.
But the deal that they had
and the
negotiated
is,
was blown
well, they,
up yesterday.
They negotiated a deal that included a lot of pet projects that they wanted.
But isn't that your problem with Speaker Mike Johnson, who negotiated that deal with them?
No, look. When you have a House Republican
majority, House Speaker negotiated that deal, right?
Would you like me to answer or you want to debate it? House Republican majority.
Debate it!
Senate Democrat majority. Democrat in the White House. Where has Joe Biden been in any of these discussions?
What difference has it got?
In any of these discussions? Nothing. So you want to just focus on House Republicans. We put a bill on the floor today to keep the government funded. Yes, some of my colleagues voted no. Some of my colleagues have never voted for a CR and never voted to increase the debt ceiling. That's their right. But the fact is, many Democrats have always voted to pass a CR and increase the debt ceiling. And the reason they didn't do that today is because they don't want to lose leverage in the new Congress.
Okay, now stop it for a second. All right, I mean, we don't need to hear any more. The most fascinating part about this is that last line that he said. Democrats always are attempt to keep the government open, but today they didn't play along with our games that we were playing. And, you know, this is the fundamental dilemma that Democrats have. When you shut down the government, it's not just like, oh, some random services don't happen and we'll pick it up in 2 weeks. You've got literally hundreds of thousands, if not a million federal workers who don't get paychecks.
Yep.
And they can't go to their landlord and go, hey, listen, will you cut me some slack? I work for the federal government. I need another week.
And
I need 2 weeks.
It affects air travel at this particular time where people are going to be traveling for the holidays. This happens every single time.
It screws up the lives of a ton of workers. And yet the sort of conventional wisdom is, well, Democrats are going to automatically vote for it anyways. So, all right, we'll talk more about that in a bit. In fact, we'll talk about it with the Congresswoman in a moment. Do we need to take a quick break? And then we'll come back with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So I'm going to start off with let's talk about what's going on, obviously, right now. At any moment, you could be called to the floor for a vote. And there's some indication of what it may be. They're now talking about splitting it up into three different bills. But just give us your sense of what's going on here, because it feels like 5 days ago, nobody predicted there'd be an issue with this.
We were totally fine. We were totally fine. Democrats and Republicans had come to a compromise. CR, you know, just government funding bill. And it's actually funny. It kind of came down to literally maybe like a 3 hour window where the schedule in the House, there was two vote series. We're supposed to vote at 1:30 and then again vote at 4:30. And so they were going to put this government spending bill that everyone had agreed to on. There's some talk about putting it through at 1:30. Mike Johnson says, you know what, let's just do it at 4:00. And in that 3 hour window, Elon Musk tweeted and it died. And then you have Trump threatening, and basically Trump threatened to primary any Republican that voted for a clean CR. And then Elon tweeted that he was threatening to primary anyone that voted for the compromise CR. And Republicans are in this moment where they don't know who their daddy is right now. And so they are just running around like chickens with their head cut off. And so we're literally in this holding pattern because of this. And it's like this recursive loop that is just shut down the government literally out of nowhere because of a tweet. It's actually insane. Like, it's actually insane.
I was a product of divorce, so I can understand what happens when mommy and daddy fight and you don't know which side to land on. But putting that aside for a moment, one question I have that does not feel like it's going to be addressed whatsoever is the $20 billion for the IRS. Mm-hmm. This was in the last budget. It was a clawback by the Republicans. But if it's a continuing resolution, it could happen again, sort of as just sort of like... I guess inertia. What is anybody talking about that at all?
Well, you know, I think that this is the core problem that they're in right now, which is that, you know, of course they need Democratic votes to pass this thing. This conference cannot keep themselves together. And so they keep trying to, but they can't. They're too much at war with themselves. And so it is something that is a priority for us. And it's not something that I think has been left aside or forgotten. This is going to be a big battle, though. And it's not going to be the last time we see this come up.
Right.
Because the Trump tax cuts are expiring next year. And this is actually what this fight is actually all about. This is why Elon is involved in this right now. Because he's not tweeting this out of nowhere. He's not coming at this out of nowhere. They are trying to lift the debt limit now because reauthorizing the Trump tax cuts next year are going to explode our federal debt. It's going to explode our deficit again. And they don't want to lift the debt limit then to do that. They want to lift it now. That's why they're
because having- that'll draw too much attention
right.
to what their tax cuts are doing. And this way, yeah. if they split it up, it's less of a story.
And that's why Elon's getting involved. His net worth has, I believe, it's almost doubled since the election. Or it's like this is what was kind of being discussed a little bit among Democratic talkers. Like they're talking about changes to Elon's net worth since the election. He is trying to further explode his net worth, and he is trying to leverage everything from income from federal contracts to, you know, reducing his own personal expenditures and reducing his taxes. And this is something that we are, you know, this is what this is about for him. Trump has a different set of priorities for himself. He's trying to, you know, line his own pockets and figure out his own political preservation in this moment. And sometimes those things are aligned and sometimes they're not. And I think right now we're in one of those friction points.
It's sort of the definition of an oligarchy where even though these guys aren't these, I mean, I mean, even though Trump's not even in office yet, his like billionaire
mob enforcer, basically,
is like controlling whether the government will stay open or not. But let's leave this for a moment because, you know, this is an ongoing story. We're going to find out maybe how this resolved, at least for the next like 3 weeks or 2 months. We'll find that out in a moment. But I want to turn to what's been going on this week in terms of your attempt to chair the government oversight committee. And my daughter had a question that sort of dovetails into this. So I figure I told her I would ask this question. She wants to know, and I think sort of these two questions sort of address that whole dynamic. One is if you feel abandoned by the Democratic Party and how so if you do. But also she wants to know how do you grapple with having to appeal to multiple different ideological groups within the Democratic Party and your constituency?
Yeah, well, two really good questions. The first one is that I don't really feel abandoned by the Democratic Party because my primary relationship that I care about the most is mass movements and mass movement politics. And part of my job and my role exists forever in this tension point between mass movements and everyday people and the establishment of the Democratic Party. And so that is always like, as long as I exist as a person, I am going to be in this waypoint between these two forces. And what I'm always trying to do is open the windows of possibility for people in the Democratic Party. And so I don't feel abandoned because my job is not to try to gain personal acceptance. My job is to try to build power for the working class. And so I feel like you have to know when to select your battles and when to force the question. And I ran to win. I always run to win. I don't pick fights that I think are losing from the jump, even if they are long shots. But I also felt like this was a win-win situation. And I felt like it was win-win because you win it in a literal sense. We're able to wield this seat. And I think I genuinely ran because I thought it was what was best for the party. And I think it was what was best for the country. And I think it was what was best for people. And that's why I did it. But I also think that it is clarifying. And sometimes when you force this question, it allows us to take measurements about where we are at. And not in a binary perspective, not just in a binary perspective either. It's not just that we won or that we lost. But even in losing, I don't think anybody in the party thought that it would be this close at the start. This is a race among, by definition, Democratic insiders, only among other members of Congress. And this is typically an environment where people like us get crushed. And the fact that it was this close, the fact that some of the most, you know, established and powerful elements of the party had to mobilize to make this result, you know, happen, that we, you know, people were hot on their heels, I think is a very good sign for us. And so that's the first question, which leads to the second question.
Right.
Is that in order for us to win, we need to win along several dimensions. And we need to know how to bring people together and cleave people together in kind of different dimensions in addition to an ideological one. If it's forever just progressives versus the establishment, and that's the only frame, then we are outnumbered. But if we can take that, preserve it, we're not abandoning it, but you add generational dimensions, you add class dimensions, you add some of these other things, this is an exercise in coalition building while preserving the integrity of our positions. And I think this was one of our first big swings at it. And I think it, as far as that goes, there was a lot of really interesting successes in that. This was
That you mean if we were to look at the votes that you got maybe on the steering committee, and if we were to look at the votes that you got on the floor, we would see you could have obviously progressives voted for you, but then maybe there are younger people who have a different idea of what partisanship looks like. I mean, I think that is a big part of the generational changes. And there may be also some people who run to the progressive positions on economics, but maybe not on immigration, or maybe not on, a picket, essentially. Or, I mean, because there are votes that I know that my daughter and I have talked about, and that we've talked about here, that you've taken that we're not excited about, mm-hmm. to say the least, you know, the anti-Semitism one in the most recent. But this is part, or you tell me, is this part of like the idea of there are certain battles where you think are maybe less consequential in the, long term, that you will sacrifice to build these coalitions for the long term?
I think that we are presently in a moment where we have to be really ruthless about what battles we pick. And we cannot pick all of them. And I think we have to be realistic about the political moment that we are in. There are moments where we have the juice to be bullish. And then there are moments where we need to like really strengthen foundationally and preserve. You know, this was a tough year for us. And it's not just about big money. It's about like organizationally on the left, we are in a challenging time. The like just everything that has gone on over the last year, there's a genocide that is happening. And this is this is rightfully been a focus of so much organizing. And it's also caused a lot of not just internal, I think questioning, assessment, how we do things on the left, but it's also been a moment where we've had tons of dark money, not just, yes, AIPAC, also crypto, also Wall Street, all these folks that are constantly waiting to pick us off. And so, you know, I think that for this purpose, when we make sure that we fight, like to me, fight like hell on the material things, like I vote consistently on withholding weapons, offensive, you know, withholding funding for offensive weapons. When it comes to some of like the finer, you know, second and third degree connections on condemning anti-Semitism, you know, if IHRA came explicitly to the floor, I would not vote to ratify it. But I think that we need to be very strategic. We cannot swing at every single pitch because we have to build. And so I do think, for example, internally, one of my big cases about in gaining support, and what is interesting is that the support that we got in this, it was not just like the Progressive Caucus plus the Hispanic Caucus, which were the two caucuses that endorsed me in this fight. We had swing district Democrats that supported me in this. We had New Dems, which is a
Pat
more...
Ryan, I think, was one of the most successful, the swing, you know, sort of the purple districts, as it were. And he, I think, spoke
on your behalf, right?
Yes. Yeah. And he outran Kamala Harris by the largest margin of any House Democrat. And so one of the things that the case that I was making to the caucus is that I can message on an economically populist message and that is my intention. Of course, we are going to fight on civil rights. We're going to fight on human dignity. We're not going to let Democrats abandon our trans community. We're not going to allow Democrats to try to run skittish on civil and human rights issues. But the selling point, the most alluring point to bring the party together and to bring them over, we have to make a case of persuasion, which is that there is no other place where we are seeing promise to win back the working class, to win back Latinos, to win back young people than right here. And the message that we can send as a party that has been really kind of cemented in this election by Trump, that Democrats are the party of the elite, which bore out in an electorate in terms of what got hemorrhaged, that the way that we counter that is a populist economic message, which in a progressive frame has the benefit of a multiracial democracy, and that is attenuated with that.
Right. And part of why, you know, I was excited about the prospect of you winning that position in to be the top Democrat on oversight was because of the fact that you could communicate that kind of thing with a really large megaphone. And I think part of maybe I saw what you did with your followers after the election, some of the voters who voted for you and Trump. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Trump's style of tweeting or truthing or whatever, he's lying all the time, but it at least simulates a level of responsiveness to the public. Yes. So my question is just like, do you think that the Democrats' message on Trump's threat to democracy was undercut by the fact that an overwhelming number of Americans thought that Biden was too old to run for a second term, and yet there was no real primary process anyway? So like, I guess in other words, do you think that the Democrats need to build back more trust and legitimacy with their base, Democratic legitimacy, by showing more responsiveness?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big part of what our case was as well. You know, I think it's interesting because a lot of people kind of talk about the gerontocracy of the Democratic Party and the way that a lot of these decisions are decided by seniority. And all of those things are true. But what is also attenuated with that is the fact that it is really hard for a lot of, I think, Democrats to wrap their head around the current media environment that we are in. And there's still like this really big attachment to the idea that CNN, MSNBC, the op-ed, you know, pages of the New York Times are where swing voters are and where everyday people are. And as we saw from the election, people who, yeah, if you ascribe to that kind of a media diet, you are overwhelmingly supporting Democrats. But there has for a very long, and this was actually part of what cut, part of what I was trying to offer the party is also part of what I think had cut against me in this race, which is that there's this idea that having this, not among all Democrats, but I think among more of the old guard, that having that kind of resonance and responsiveness is gauche and lowbrow and unsophisticated. And it's attention seeking. Like the fact that a person has attention means that they are attention seeking, as opposed to the fact that they are talking to people. And so I feel okay because at the end of the day, I'm going to keep doing that. I am going to continue to do that. I wanted to do it at behest of not just like the party for the sake of the party, but because we are on the precipice of a fascist administration coming in.
Right. And your level of partisanship would have been a benefit, right? I mean, it's also about acting partisan with the Republicans and not exceptionalizing MAGA and Trump and saying Trump is the Republicans and the Republicans right. are Trump.
Right, right. And so, but I don't think that window has necessarily passed.
Well, time's sort of on your side on some level in this dynamic, right? I mean, we're seeing that develop. I don't know why it develops more quickly on the Republican side. And maybe that's just because they don't have a seniority system. They don't have a seniority system, and they don't even, but even in the context of their media, like, they developed, you know, talk radio first. They, and then they've put a lot more money into the online stuff, and there's an investment there, and they don't seem as reluctant to do that. And just lastly, because I know you got to go, but part of this dynamic of the way that young people are getting their media now, it seems to me, is that what we've seen with Gaza and what's happening with Israel is akin, in my mind, to what happened with the Vietnam War, when we saw for the first time reporters were actually involved in the war. And for people who had, you know, more skin in the game, insofar as like I could get drafted or my kids could get drafted, that really changed the politics in a way that I don't think the upper echelon or the old guard, as it were, of whatever was happening at that time in this country understood. And I feel like that same dynamic is happening now. If you're under the age of 40, what's gone on in Israel is in Palestine and Gaza in particular, obviously, and the West Bank for that matter, is very different from your perception if you're over the age of 40 because of where you get your media.
I have said this directly to Democratic leadership. I've communicated this to the White House, that this is our Vietnam. This is our, not just like in terms of the party, but this is just our country's Vietnam. And what I think a lot of people do not yet understand is they think this is, that some of these hemorrhages are maybe ideological. They think maybe it is like an ethnic thing. I don't think there is appreciation yet about how generationally radicalizing this moment is, and how shocked people are at how far just like the general inertia is willing to go, as if we're not seeing what's happening right before our very eyes. I mean, we are now at the point where, you know, in where I exist, me calling this a genocide, going to the House floor, delivering a speech saying that the administration is aiding and abetting this is so far beyond the fringe, so far beyond the pale. This is also part of what this dynamic was in this vote, too. It came up like, let's just be, to call a spade, that was also an element in this fight. But I think that it is important that we lay these markers down again generationally, because people see what is happening, and we need to have some sort of legitimacy if we seek to reinstate an order around human rights and actual care for democracy. And, you know, that is the benefit of being, of trying to be consistent. And so when I see these losses, they're not devastating to me, because I think they are important waypoints for us to see. It's not just a loss. Like, again, in the context of the Democratic caucus, in the context of a three-term member of Congress running to become a ranking member of a committee against, you know, someone that has decades of experience here, to have to gain that waterline of 84 Democrats in an internal fight is actually, it is something that people were taken aback by. And we will see, what do we do with that? I don't know. But it is a chip that we have. And we'll have to see other people we can elevate and support and see how all of these things interact. But at the end of the day, it's something that I think was a net gain for all of us to be able to engage in.
Yeah, I suspect that 130 on the other side or so were surprised. And they're, I don't know if put on notice is the right way of putting it, but they're aware that maybe there's something they might be missing. Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And good luck with whatever you end up having to vote on today. Hopefully there is something to vote for, because it makes a material difference for a lot of people that we operate the government. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ryan Grimm will be here. We will be talking about some of the same things probably with Ryan as we did the congresswoman. But I think, maybe we could talk about that. We could talk about it in the fun half a little bit. But it is good to hear her explanation that at the very least, she has, as far as I can tell, what I think, your mileage may vary, different people, but a rationale for her approach. I think there's maybe plenty of room to argue as to, you know, how that gets executed, but there's a plan there, and it's a plan of a politician, not a plan of someone who is an activist or a media commentator. It's a plan of a politician.
It's about gaining power
and working within a certain context too. Right. And so, all right, quick break. Ryan Grimm, co-founder of Dropsite News, will be joining us in a moment. We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It is our final live show of the year. And as such, Ryan Grimm, reporter and co-founder of Dropsite News, also a co-host of Counterpoints, has dressed up. And it's much appreciated. Look at you. Look at you.
A Christmas green as well.
I had a t-shirt on until like just recently. My wife was like, please don't do that. Don't. Come on. Have some dignity. It's like, fine.
I know that's your way of covering for saying that you wanted to dress up. And
I would tell you the truth.
But no wins are not today, so Sam doesn't get to rip into
it. It's his casual Friday dress.
Got it.
Yeah, he really has nailed it. Ryan, when we booked you, I thought this was going to be like a full roundup of the end of the year type of thing where we're going forward, but because I thought on Monday it was sort of a done deal that there was going to be, a continuing resolution, very sort of vanilla. There were some add-ons that were in it. This very controversial measure of paying for disaster relief or this very controversial measure of funding cancer studies for kids and treatment for kids or but somehow this all blew up. At one point, it looked like this week, wait, are we going to get rid of the debt ceiling forever? And just give us your sense of where we're at this point. It's sort of insane.
I think what we're really looking at is if you step back, a significant number of steps, what you see is it is kind of an existential fight over the role of Congress. And I say this judgment free. I'm not saying Congress is good and should be part of our system or Congress is bad and shouldn't be. But I think what Musk in particular is trying to do here is to basically turn Congress into a sub branch of government that we're certainly when it's controlled by Republicans is completely at the will and the mercy of the president. Or, and when I say the president, I'm not doing the facetious like Musk thing, but like Musk's ability to primary members of the House in particular, and Musk's, you know, reach through social media and his popularity with the Republicans, he wants to be able to tweet something and that be a dictate to the House of Representatives in particular, but Congress in general. And I think he's trying that stuff out now. His post yesterday, I think it was, where he said, not a single bill should pass between now and when Trump takes office. Like he wants those to be orders that are just given to another branch of government and just followed. And that is a system of government that a lot of countries have. It's just not the one that we've always had.
That's the amazing thing about this is that, like, you know, we have talked about, you know, and Sanders has been talking about this for, you know, decades, really, in many respects. We're headed this way. The idea of a billionaire, when the party's still out of, you know, it's not like this is Trump's in office. It's not like they've, you know, this is just him sort of almost like transpartisan on some level. And of course, he's just leveraging the Republican Party. But we've had money that, of course, is going to play in primaries, right? Like, you know, we saw this with Cory Bush and Jamal Bowman. We've seen it, Jayapal as well, where like DMFI comes in and, you know, AIPAC money, or, you know, other big industry. But we saw it with crypto money in Ohio. But the idea that one person has enough money to beat all of these people and it happens to be aligned with all those people I just said, but which I don't think is a coincidence, but the idea that he can deploy this and they know, like, there's someone to the right of me who's just as, like, and the only thing they have to do is say, and this is their primary, all they have to say is they have more fealty to Musk and Trump or whatever you want to call it than I do. And here's the evidence. And we're 2 years out. You can't get further from their potential.
But they're not sworn in yet.
Yeah. That's my point. This is like, he's now threatening, like, you know, he's like threatening politicians in the womb, essentially, with primaries for positions they don't even hold yet, technically. It's fascinating. Yes.
It's never happened before that, you know, even AIPAC, when they go after, you know, half a dozen to a dozen, you know, left-wing Democrats in 2022 or 2024, for instance, like to spend $100 million, they at least had to go out and hold some fundraisers and make some phone calls and hit up individual people for, you can look at their, you know, you can go to the FEC and see like $1 million, $1 million, $1 million, $5 million, $10 million, $1 million, $500,000, $500,000. And then you'll see a ton of six-figure checks all at the same day. So you're like, oh, there was a fundraiser this day, all these people gave $100,000, and eventually they've raised $100 million and they spend it. That is a disproportionate asymmetrical amount of power that they have to basically anybody else in politics until Elon Musk steps in. He doesn't need to even organize a fundraiser among 100 people that give $100,000 or 10 people that give $1 million each. He can just say, all right, here's a super PAC that is going to focus in this district. I'm going to put $5 million in it, and a tiny amount of money for him. And it's going to run ads starting now for 2 years saying that this guy's not sufficiently loyal to Donald Trump. And that has never happened before, ever. Like nothing even remotely close to that has happened. And so if they had a cushion of 10 or 15 votes, I think this game plan would be easy to execute. The fact that they're such a narrow margin means it's going to be tricky, and he's going to cause, I think he may push too far and too fast and screw things up for Trump. And then Trump tells him, you know what? I don't actually, this is not actually helpful to me right now. So that's the only thing. It's not really anything Democrats can do about it. It's just, they have to just kind of fail on their own.
But part of also what, you know, Representative Ocasio-Cortez was saying to us is that Elon feels that he's reliant on this push for his own financial gain, for tax cuts. That's really what he's in it for. And I guess that probably elongates the level of, like, the amount that Trump and Musk are tied together. If his self-interest is so specifically tied to this agenda and to the tax cuts, then, like, the breaking of up of the two over their egos, it's going to be harder to pull off, which I naively thought maybe they had a chance with some of the trolling, but it doesn't seem like that's
happening. No, and let me just
they're feeling themselves.
What does that look like?
Yeah.
Like, what? Like this whole thing about, right. like, you know, President Musk so that it gets under Trump's skin. Look, if I, you know, if I thought it was in my power, I would, you know, I would stoop to, like, putting, you know, when we were kids, they had little, like, asbestos tins of, like, itching powder. And I would put that in, you know, like, I'm not above any of this. But in terms of efficacy, this whole President Musk thing is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Because, A, let's say Musk was to go away. And then you still have the same problem. Like, this is a problem with Republicans. If it wasn't Musk, it would be Miriam Adelson. If it wasn't Miriam Adelson, it'd be some other billionaire. I mean, to make it about Musk is stupid because there is no long-term messaging there. But the other thing is, in what world is it in either Musk's or Trump's best interest? Even if Trump is like, you know, like a bait, like literally like a baby. And, you know, they still are going to be smart. Like, maybe they're not going to hang out as much. And somebody's going to write a story in the Post or the Times like, there seems to be a chill between Musk and Trump. Who gives a shit? Because at the end of the day, their interests are aligned. They're both basically, you know, autocratic kleptocrats. And it's just like they may have to negotiate. You know what? It's not 50-50 anymore. It's 60-40 or it's 35-65, whatever. Like, this is the dumbest thing. This is literally, this is so baby-brained. This is junior high school stuff. And we need people playing in the big leagues, it feels like.
And so what I mean by them failing is that they are unable to run their operation. In other words, let's say that they do actually shut the government down. You know, Musk is, you know, obviously a very, like, intelligent guy, like, you know, off the charts IQ, that sort of thing. He really has no idea what he's talking about when it comes to government.
None.
I don't think he understands what the consequences would be for the Trump administration of shutting the government down for the entire transition. Like, A, if you don't call the inauguration essential services, he doesn't even get to give a speech outside of Congress. He'd have to do his swearing in inside the White House. Musk doesn't care about that.
Yeah.
This is where interests are disaligned. Like,
right.
Obviously, Trump does care about that. But the transition is much more than just the party on the
moment. My gosh, they would be starting 90 days late, essentially.
And that's a misaligned incentive right there between the two of them. Musk might be fine with all that chaos. His net worth might grow, might not, but it might at that time. You know, the weaker the government is, the more powerful, you know, he is. But Trump, I think, is actually enjoying this round of his election so much more than 2016. You know, 2016, you know, he won as a fluke. He lost to Hillary Clinton by 3 million votes, which he was mortally embarrassed about. He squeaks through because of this technicality of the Electoral College and these really narrow wins in three states. He spends all his time fending off these charges that actually he didn't really win because Putin helped him. The day after he's inaugurated, he's defending his pitiful little inauguration crowds. While there's 5 million people, mostly women, which is deeply offensive to him, marching in the streets against him.
Yeah.
And his approval rating is like 20s, 30s, like out of the gate. He was miserable and lashing out and cranky. I think you can just feel his vibes. He's feeling his oats a lot more this time. He loves that he actually won because he does trust the numbers now. And Musk risks that honeymoon with like a stupid government shutdown the entire time. So that's what I mean about that they just might not have the competence to pull it off. And also Trump is surrounded by morons.
I don't know what they could pull off. I don't even know what pull it off ends up being at this point. Like, they've already damaged themselves. Even if they get their continuing resolution, they're not going to get the erasure of the debt ceiling. It seems to me it's either going to have to be completely gone or as it is now, so that he has to deal with it. Because as the congresswoman was saying to us, like, they don't want those two things to be the tax cuts and the debt ceiling to be sort of like in any type of proximity with each other, because then people start doing the math. And right. What's his face? The bald guy. Chip Roy gets on the floor. And he's like, why? You know, what are the Republicans? And so I don't know. This is it is fascinating. It's a lot more interesting than I thought maybe it would be. It's also terrifying. Like we've arrived now. You have one guy who has the ability to essentially, and remember, you know, $1 billion for a campaign to raise is a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
I don't know what the record is.
Presidential campaign. Yeah.
Yeah. And he can deploy this and still have 200 times more money than he had 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Like it's insane. The amount of power that this guy now has because of his money, the money that he's amassed. The idea that, like, you know, we don't have like 12 alarm bells going off, and it's really just more about like, oh, you know, who's the real president? You know, like, I'm sorry that we are not meeting the moment with that stuff. It seems to me, but so what do you think the prospects are for the future?
I mean, a shutdown would be such a mess for them that I feel like they're going to capitulate and get it together, but maybe not. I don't, like, they might just screw this up. Like it's possible.
Do you think that also what is scary for me, at least, it's scary that it's almost like Donald Trump's constituency, all there's not really much of a promises that were even made really in the campaign except for Project 2025, which he distanced himself from, but cuts and cuts and cuts, and immigration, all of this stuff, this looting of the government and the taking a wrecking ball to the administrative state, there's also no constituency that he has to respond to. That's the other part of this, which is like the substanceless campaign outside of just hate. Like that element, I think, emboldens him further.
Yeah, and also I think what Musk is doing here has so much of an artificial element to it that's one reason you could actually see Republicans like getting themselves back together, dusting themselves off, and actually passing this again. Like Musk had the ability to stop the thing, cause absolute total chaos, but that wasn't because like a million people marched on Washington. Yes, there's a bunch of people retweeting his posts that he puts in front of everybody's face, but it is still somewhat artificial. And so if he takes his foot off the gas on it, then it just goes away. It's not as if it's this organic movement that is going to, you know, continue on its own. The Republicans are going to try to move on their own. But yeah, I think the promises Trump made are he's going to entertain his supporters, and he's going to, you know, cause pain, either public or civil or criminal, for his supporters' enemies. Like those are the things he's going to do. And he's already, you know, I think as long as he does that sort of stuff theatrically, he'll like, that's what he wants to do. Like, and then I feel like he'll deliver. Now other people around him, you know, want real material, substantive, results. But him, I think he's happy to just like, if you notice this recently, he's like browbeating the EU. He's like, if the EU doesn't buy more oil and gas from the United States, it's tariffs all the way down for them. And so he gets to make this huge threat about these, you know, these gay Europeans. and then he gets to back down when he points to some numbers about oil and gas that they bought.
That seems to be, I want to turn to sort of the Democrats and ask you what you thought about the AOC, but it seems to me that like there is a world in which Trump's most excessive things are just used as, like, you know, threats that he knows people don't really follow. He just, like, it's a way for him to rack up wins.
And that half of his people told pollsters they liked him because they didn't think he was going to do those things.
Yes.
They like that he said it, but they also like that they don't believe that he's going
to
do it.
And so he's going to be able to just talk about wins, wins, wins all over the place for stuff that is almost pre-existing. And claim that it happened because, you know, he knows how to negotiate and bargain. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you happen to believe that government actually has a function, it's not a great strategy. But if you're looking just to sell a brand, I mean, it's a great strategy because there's really very little cost associated with it. And it's hard to lose in that situation. All right. Yeah. So with that said, give me a sense of what you think, like, where is the Democratic Party in terms of, like, being able to deal with this? We just what's your take? Let's just start with this AOC committee chair race. Hmm. What's your takeaway? I mean, she seemed to argue that 84 votes was good. It gives a marker. She wanted to win. She thought she could win, maybe, but that 84 votes is a good marker as to, like, where the balance of power across various different planes, if you will, exist.
And here's the saddest part, that she's right about that when it comes to the perspective of members of the House. Like Democratic members of the House genuinely were surprised that she got as many as 84 votes. And, like, the sad part is that A, it's only 84 votes, and B, that they're surprised about that, and C, that it shows that they actually don't have any interest in radically rethinking the way that they do politics.
Yeah.
Like, if they, like, a shellacking like this to some institutions would yield a radical rethinking of what they're doing. All right, what have we done wrong here? What has been working? What works for us that we can put out in front? What can we do differently? Instead, they're comparing themselves to 2022, 2018, saying, like, hey, it's a fourth term. You know, she's coming into her fourth term and she won 84 votes. Like, that's historic compared to what it was like in the 90s or what it was like in the 1950s and what it was like in the 1930s. So they're still stuck in this thinking of themselves as this long, continuous institution that changes extremely slowly while the entire world is spinning around them at an exponentially faster rate and breaking them while they're not even noticing.
I had Dan on the other day on his piece, you know, how the Democrats are rudderless. I mean, because when you say they, it's almost like giving they too much credit, as if they are an entity, as opposed to just, you know, a bunch of people who just happen to find themselves in the same cloakroom. And, you know, maybe within, you know, somewhat aligned in terms of policies, but, you know, some not, frankly. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be such a massive vacuum of leadership. Yep. And I'm not even talking about somebody who's, like, actively being a leader, but, like, to look to Chuck Schumer for any type of direction, right? In many respects, he's the most senior. Well, he's the most senior elected official, a Democrat. And to look to him for any type of, like, signal of, like, where should we head is like, it's like some type of, like, Escher painting. Like, all you're doing is you're looking back at yourself somehow. Like, you look at him and you just see you're looking into the mirror.
So Democrats have spent 40 years now, basically since Reagan, being not Republicans rather than being anything, which makes for, like you said, a coalition of people who look around at the cloakroom and are like, what do we have in common other than the fact that, like, we're not Republicans? And Republicans are now changing, you know, substantially. Like, the Republican Party of 2024 is not the Republican Party of 94 or 2004. And so if you're a party that has no identity other than not being Republicans, but Republicans are all changing in weird ways that are confusing to you, then what are you?
Right.
Rudderless is what they are. Yeah.
Do you see like where, like, I mean, I guess it's just a question of like, it's impossible to sort of predict who emerges as a leader out of this. I mean, certainly that vote in the House was like some sense of like, well, we definitely don't think it's going to be AOC, or we don't want it to be AOC.
It's Jerry Connolly.
Jerry Connolly. I mean,
oh, I'm excited already.
Of all the esophageal cancer patients in their 70s, he would be the one I would want, though. I would say that. Like, let's be honest. Yeah, for a guy who has esophageal cancer and in that age,
he's got
some pep in his step. And that's
now
the kind
never, Jerry. Yeah.
DEI hire. Yeah. I mean, I guess, like, but that, I guess, brings us to the Wall Street Journal 50 sourced piece that came out this week about Biden, which we went through yesterday. And the leadership vacuum that he's left is, I think, one of the worst parts of his legacy, the genocide that he supported, pretty big stain. But that element of like them knowing as soon as 2019 that they didn't want Jill Biden out there because she looked more energetic than her husband, 8 years younger than him. You're already doing that kind of management. And then, frankly, it's why Harris was in the closet. They weren't putting her out there to highlight that contrast either. So Biden consciously undercut any other leadership opportunities for Democrats that were rising. Didn't even need to be her. And it probably wouldn't have been at the end of the day. But because it was all this group of sycophants cementing, insulating him from questioning, and also making sure that there was no question, he's the president. That's it.
Yeah, we just reshared on the Dropside Twitter feed the Julian Castro debate moment from 2020, if you remember. Where
yes.
He was basically driven out of the race for calling out Biden for being, you know, mentally infirm. In 2019, if you remember, when Biden was campaigning in Iowa, there were these stories about how he would speak to audiences of, say, 50 people, you know, 10 of those would go in as supporters and like two would emerge still supporting him. Like, because of his sheer inability to string sentences together or to seem remotely presidential. This was 2019 in Iowa. He then finished fourth in Iowa as a result, because Iowa voters
get up close. Yeah.
Actually saw him. And they're like, no, this is ridiculous. Then he finished fifth in New Hampshire, because New Hampshire voters also get to see people up close. And then in Nevada, it's a two-person race between him and Bernie. Bernie beats him 2-1.
Yep.
Democratic voters knew in 2019 that this guy was not ready to be president. They were looking for anybody but him. And then they're just told by Obama and Clyburn and Buttigieg and Klobuchar and MSNBC and CNN, with their hundreds of millions of dollars have earned, you know, unearned media, saying like, look, everybody's consolidating behind Biden to beat Bernie. And
well, I mean, to be
like,
fair,
okay, yeah,
listen, there was a real fear amongst a lot of us that if Bernie won, we would be lined up in Central Park and shot because of
look at Luigi Mangione.
Side.
I yes. mean, later we'll play Eric Adams saying how we need to respect CEO trauma right now, and that there's not enough of sensitivity about this class of individual and their trauma.
And for viewers who've forgotten, that's it. Chris Matthews said that on air.
I was in that room that night and went up afterwards and on the air. And I was like, well, excuse me, what are we talking about here? And, but that is on Obama, right? Like there's, you know, why Chuck Schumer, like somehow Chuck Schumer's not in that Wall Street Journal piece, right? Mm. I mean, you can feel, you can almost hear
his aides. You can hear his aides speaking anonymously. Yeah.
Yes, but you can hear Chuck Schumer himself like running as far away from like any mention in that piece as possible. But the fact is like, where was Chuck Schumer 2 years ago? Who is the titular head of the league? Where was Barack Obama? I understand. Listen, I've been in that business. You got to be available for meetings. if you're pitching a show, you guys, you know, when you're coming up with a show, you're like, that's the whole world you're inhabiting. Like, what are the characters like? You know, what's going to be the arc? But if you're going to dip in to the election, the primaries, which, like, okay, anybody can be a political actor, but, like, do you have no sense of obligation to sort of, like, if you're going to exercise that kind of power, do you, you know, my Uncle Ben used to say to me, with great power comes great responsibility. And I mean, honestly, it's so ridiculous the way that these people are operating. And I, you know, I feel the same thing about the incompetence of people like Plouffe and like Cutter and, you know, Dylan, that their incompetence is bred by a certain ideology. Like, that sort of ideology breeds a certain type of incompetence, because it's just, there's a lot of CYA and there's a lot of like, well, what can you do?
Right. Right. Because it's kind of accountability free. Like, the bigger risk would be losing to the left than losing to Republicans that over their entire career. So that's really molded them. It's what's so stunning about their belief that they were going to be able to run Biden again was that the only reason they were able to run him that time was that
because of COVID
scenario. And then COVID mid-March, we didn't see him again through November.
That was the best thing that could have ever happened to his campaign was
Biden in the basement.
I can't leave, you know, because of COVID. And on some level, like that.
And Trump being the actual president and everybody wanting him out.
Yeah.
So they had those two things going for them, and they had zero of those things going for him. And they had him 4 years older than he was.
Right. Right.
So how they thought they were going to be able to force that down people's throats is beyond me.
I don't know if we can calculate the cost of Biden's inability to use the bully pulpit, especially in the communications environment that we live in now. Why AOC is potent, which is what I said to her, and why Trump is. They are trying to talk to you directly. And Trump's lying by Truth Social or whatever. But it feels to voters like a level of responsiveness that a guy like Biden, who didn't say anything publicly, basically, for the final 2 years of his presidency, they didn't feel that on top of all of the other reasons that we talk about with him. And, you know, no president ever gotten reelected with his approval rating, and it bore out.
And he was the most economic populist president we've had since probably FDR, and he never said a word about it. Said a word that anybody could like absorb.
Could understand.
This is the paradox, right? Like, because you read that piece in the Journal and you start to wonder, like, okay, his administration was the most populist, certainly of our time. And the value, this is frankly like why, like, I was like, I'm happy. I don't, if we have a Reagan situation, and I think the Reagan situation is very analogous to this on some level, except for, you know, Reagan was, it was almost like built in that Reagan was going to be a little bit like that. And, you know, whatever. It was a different era in terms of like exposure. You know, if it was 50 years ago and there's only three stations, you know, Biden could have maybe won again, you know, in that environment. The Reagan era, you just had some of the worst players in U.S. government were basically running the ship, and he was not.
Yeah. So I think you're right.
With Biden, we had, you know, early on, he farmed out antitrust to Elizabeth Warren. He farmed out labor to Bernie Sanders. And he basically farmed out, and we didn't, you know,
Ron Klain's running the show.
Yes, he farmed out foreign policy to Dick Cheney, essentially. And I mean, I maybe not literally, but certainly pretty close.
Jake Sullivan, and
I mean, these people are of that ilk. And then just like, you know, everything was just trying to have as many good days as you can.
It says in the piece in 2021 that aide said to the other, he has good days and bad days.
Yes.
And then they were also, he wasn't receiving the polling information. It wasn't clear because the pollsters weren't allowed to talk to him directly in 2024.
I mean, it doesn't sound like a fucking Mike Donilon. But My point is like,
yeah,
you know, short of who he farmed out foreign policy to, I'm okay with a caretaker presidency. Like as in there needs to be a caretaker for the president and,
yeah,
you know, other people are doing the actual stuff because he had basically given it out to different people. But that, you know, it turns out you also got to run for president.
Yeah. And one piece of evidence that, you know, it wasn't really him running, you know, because this wasn't his politics for, you know, the 60 years or whatever that he's been in politics. And that phrase that they use to describe his populist economics, from the middle out, it makes no sense. Nobody understands what it means. You focus group it. People are like, what is this? What? But I think Biden liked it because he's middle class Joe. You know, he calls himself that. And so I think they framed the economic politics that they wanted to run as this middle out to him. Like, he was the only audience, I think, for that ridiculous brand that they put on it. And they're like, all right, if we can get Joe bought in by calling it middle out, let's just call it middle out, and then we'll do our thing.
Same. Are you guys doing the middle out? Hey, man, where's the...
Same with foreign policy for the middle class. Remember that? That was how Jake Sullivan sold his foreign policy. Foreign policy for the middle class.
Yes.
Yeah.
What does that mean? They're invested in arms dealers?
It means that, like, when we're hawkish on China...
It makes sense to one person.
Yeah, right. Well, right, exactly. You're right. It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't really make sense. It just lands in his brain, and a light goes off. He hears the word middle class.
Yeah, I mean, yes. He must have been like, God damn it. I've been doing this for 60 years and I never thought of that. Yes. Damn it.
How generous of you to assume he had the thought.
No, damn it. That sounds good.
Yeah. People are going to love this. Oh, and the other piece of
Hunter,
evidence,
get in here.
He was always calling Larry Summers for advice. Larry Summers was completely shut out by his entire economic policy team because they thought all of his ideas were incorrect, like a Kramer style. Whatever he says, let's do the opposite.
Right.
Yet Biden would talk to him regularly. But then whatever he told Biden would just be completely ignored. So I think that's another indication that was just the way they placated Biden. Like, all right, it's called middle out and Larry Summers likes it. Here, talk to Larry. And Larry would tell him, just don't do all the things that your team
does. Do you
want to
read the latest Matt Iglesias piece, Mr. President? Here, look at this.
Yes.
And Micah and Joe, look at, they look so good today, don't they? They're my
friends.
All right. So, Ryan, this is our final live show of the year. And we've talked about the now sort of like not theoretical, but we've reached oligarchic stage. Like in a very obvious fashion, I think. And we've talked about the fecklessness of the Democrats and the fact that we had a pretend president for 4 years. Positive note, what's going to be positive in 2025?
AOC, I think you got a little bit of news out of AOC there that could be in a positive direction that I could underline. When she said that as she was running for ranking member, the case that she made to the caucus was that she would lead with economic populism, that she is very good at messaging around economic populism. And she was contrasting that with leading around the cultural politics. You know, that's why she said, you know, that's why she followed it in your interview by saying, don't worry.
I'm still
multiracial.
Yes,
right. Yeah.
It's like whenever you start saying that, it's clear. You de-emphasized it. And she's specifically saying that she's de-emphasizing that and re-emphasizing the economic politics, economic populism. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. It's no secret. That's what I've always felt. I think, and I think that you actually will win the cultural fights by winning those fights. Like, I think you fight and lose on the cultural fights, then you lose them both. You have to fight on the economic populism and then you win them both.
Yep.
I definitely saw it in the context of when I mentioned Pat Ryan and said immigration, because I just happen to know, like, I'm familiar with Pat Ryan.
That's your man, right?
No, I mean, I'm the 19th. He's the 18th. If he was the 19th for a brief moment. But right. He used to do regular interviews on my on the radio station I listened to up there via the internet. It's very effective. When he was county supervisor. And, you know, he is has the sensibility of an economic populist. I think he's probably more to the left in general than he is as a, you know, politician. He's a vet. His immigration stance, I'm not terribly thrilled about. He got and that was really the one that, like, probably the one position that he held that I don't subscribe to in New York State. It's a very difficult environment right now for that, because of the way that Hochul and Adams, I mean, it's been framed that way, and Swazi's win, right. That's like you're really swimming against the tide. But he ran on two things in terms of what his mass media was: Social Security, protecting Social Security, and abortion rights. And, you know, Social Security is the Democratic populist message. That's where it all emanates from, it seems to me. You want to expand Social Security, there's you understand the value of a universal program and getting everybody involved, and you understand the value of, like, mandates and all of this. All of the sort of, like, Democratic populist measures are manifested through Social Security. And I think, like, we're watching the maturation of a politician. It's just, hopefully it's not like the maturation process is not like a Nancy Pelosi maturation process, right? I mean, but I don't know if San Francisco was ever about populism, even 40 years ago, when it wasn't like it is today in terms of where the money is.
Right. And she always represented the establishment wing of the San Francisco Democratic Party against its more insurgent wing anyway.
All right. Well, on that note, I'm trying to sum up your positive message. So
some AOC's Democrats are going to lean into
economic populism.
Wow, that's really tepid. That's really tepid. That's a very tepid positive message for 2025. Anything else? Like, I don't know.
Well, I think they're already talking about, you know, candidates for 2028. So the idea that 2024 is going to be the last presidential election, I think we can probably put that fear to rest. I think we're going to have more elections. So that's something.
That's good to hear.
That's good to know.
But
yeah.
It's still, you know, 4 years away. They're not even, they haven't even taken the oath of office yet. So I'm not sure we can bank that. But as Edward Gregorian says on our IMs, this is why they call him Ryan Grimm. And Ryan, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great 2024. Folks should check out DropSite News. You guys have been breaking stories, it feels like, every week.
Yeah, we're on a roll. A lot of big hits.
Really are.
Yeah, good Cuba piece coming today, you'll like.
Oh. All right. So, folks, check out DropSite News. And Ryan, have a great holiday and good new year. And we'll see you in 2025.
All right. See you there.
All right.
See you, Ryan.
That's why they call him Ryan Grimm, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, before you go, it's a busy time of year. It's going to be busy next year. Things are going to be crazy. You want to save some valuable time? Fewer trips to the grocery store, but you still want to make nice home-cooked meals for your kids, for your husband, for your wife, for your parents, whoever it is that you make your food for. HelloFresh. I want to thank HelloFresh for supporting the Majority Report. And here's an offer from HelloFresh. Get 10 free meals at HelloFresh.com/freemajority. Not only is HelloFresh a great sort of like ingredient, I don't know what they call it. What's the overall thing? They send you ingredients and they give you obviously a recipe and you create these delicious meals, a lot of which, like, well, not a lot, but there's a decent amount of them, enough for me anyways, where you can make them in one pan and you can make them in 20 minutes.
Very nice.
Like, I've had some pork taco stuff that I made for the kids, 20 minutes, cleanup's a breeze. Fresh ingredients, delicious. The great thing, too, about HelloFresh is they have like a market where you can get about 100 different items, staples that you need, stuff that you don't want to have to keep going out to the supermarket for. All of HelloFresh's recipes include high-quality, sustainably sourced ingredients, produce that comes fresh from the farm, and there are 50 chef-crafted recipes to choose from every single week. And you can customize these things so the meals can be, you know, exactly as you want them. If you don't want this, you don't want that. Sometimes I'll skip, like, one of my kids doesn't like cilantro. But, of course, cilantro is one of the best ingredients there is.
And so, it is.
But that makes it a little more complicated sometimes. But whatever. If you're traveling for the holidays or too busy to cook at home, you can easily skip a week's delivery if you need to. This is a great service. They have like a cousin, like Factor Meals. And so we switch back and forth on those. So I can make some meals and then I can also just heat up some meals. But the HelloFresh is fantastic. It makes me feel like I'm cooking for my kids because I am. Get 10 free meals at HelloFresh.com/freemajority. That's applied across 7 boxes. New subscribers only. Varies by plan. That's 10 free HelloFresh meals just by going to HelloFresh.com/freemajority. Also, another service I've been using for years and years, well before they ended up becoming a sponsor. I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you've ever Googled yourself or searched around on some of these, like, you know, people finding sites or whatnot. But your relative's personal information could be sold right on now, and you would know this. And not only do they sell things like home addresses or phone numbers, or email addresses that are associated with it, sometimes also social media sites. But if somebody's searching on your relative stuff, they can find your name and your information that way too. Some of these sites are just nuts. And for me, for years and years, it has been an issue that there are people out there who want to send me mean letters or to visit me at times where I have not invited them, and people I don't know or whatnot. And one of the ways that I have dealt with this over the years has been Delete Me. They are sponsoring today's program, and I want to thank them for doing that. And I will tell you, Delete Me has been a way in which I have one of the mechanisms, and basically the primary one, in which I have tried to protect myself and my family in particular. Delete Me is a subscription service. It removes your personal info from hundreds of data broker sites. It's a service that removes your information and then continuously does it. Because what happens with the data brokers, they have to take it down once they're asked. And Delete Me goes around and asks on a continuous basis. But then after a certain period of time, they repopulate it. And Delete Me is constantly working to pull down your information. This holiday season, give your loved ones the gift of privacy and peace of mind with Delete Me. Take control of your data. Keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now at a special discount for our listeners, get 20% off your Delete Me plan by texting MAJORITY to 64,000. That's text MAJORITY to 64,000. MAJORITY to the number 64000. And what they also do, I should say, it's not in this copy, but they send an email every month to give you a roundup of like where, you know, what they have done and what's out there.
Yeah.
So very, very helpful. Good for you and your family. Check it out. Folks, this is our final free show.
Yes.
Of the year, at least live one. We have 6 or 7 really great best ofs.
We'll be back the 2nd for people.
We'll be back on January 2nd, raring to go. you know, making the plans over the vacation. I'm sitting down, you know, like what kind of stuff we're going to do. I think, you know, I can tell you right now, we're going to try and pay attention to what's happening within the context of agencies, so that, you know, to the extent that we can know, it's sometimes difficult to find out what's going in these things. But so that you can, you know, get a sense of just like what the implications are of a Republican administration and one that is so explicit in its desire to undermine the efficacy of government and protect citizens from essentially capitalists, corporations who want to privatize their profits and socialize the costs, which means in getting either society to pay for it through taxation and subsidies or through dealing with, I don't know, opioid addiction or dealing with, you know, people having cancer because some company finds it more profitable to dump their stuff in a river or, you know, scam artists or selling crypto or whatever it is. And so that's where at least part of our efforts are going to go. And also giving, you know, we're going to continue to have people on to talk about visions of what could be and other systems which would be better than our current one. And also, you know, looking back in history for lessons of where things might go and what might have been and where some of these ideologies are born out of and what's driving our politics. And then, of course, you know, we'll keep up with the news of the day and there'll be more. I also will mention this when we get into FunF, but I want to thank our members because you guys make it really possible for us to do this show day in, day out. You know, sometimes we have ebb and flows with advertisements. Sometimes, you know, we feel comfortable like rejecting ads.
I will just say last year, YouTube clearly made a change to the algorithm that I would say cut about 25% of revenue from YouTube just on January 1st.
Oh yeah. No, things there in YouTube, the vagaries of YouTube, we don't, you know, advertise it. We don't pretend that it's like, we're being shut out because of our ideology or this and that. And, you know, look, they're a business. They're selling to advertisers. They don't like it. And, you know, we spent a lot of the year
talking about Gaza.
Talking about Gaza. And, you know, I don't know that YouTube doesn't have an ideology beyond what's going to make them money and what's going to avoid risk for them. That's the way that, you know, these enterprises work. But we're not going to, our members make it possible for us not, to care what the algorithm is doing with stories that we want to cover, or are we, you know, we don't, I can assure you, I'm not even sure how to do this, although I know it's best practices. Look at what trending topics or what words, you know, we should be putting in our titles. I mean, I hope Dorsey does some of that, but we don't cover stories based on that. Let's put it that way. We just don't do it. And we don't have to because of our members. And I'm not going to say that if we didn't have members that we would do it, we would probably
because you'd quit. Have to learn who Timothée Chalamet is and stuff like that.
I did find out just the other day.
Dune guy.
The Dune guy. I just saw an ad for that Dylan thing, and I'm like, you told me that, right?
Yeah. It's supposed to be good. It's supposed to be good, and I think like...
No, but you told me it was that Chalamet guy.
Yeah.
Who was the Dune guy.
Yep.
And I'm like, this guy's that big of an actor?
Yeah, I mean, he's really talented. I don't know what to tell you. He's really good.
Well, you know, maybe good. I know a lot of talented actors, and nobody knows who they are.
Right. I mean, maybe he could prove his bona fides by spitting out some steak on Sex and the City or something like that.
Oh, that was actually some very good work. Mm-hmm. I remember that. Anyways, I want to thank our members. Very much appreciated. And if you want to become one, join themajorityreport.com. Also, I want to thank everybody who works on this show. Obviously, Emma, Bradley, and Matt. But folks that you don't see behind the scenes. Dorsey, who is like technically probably, I don't know if he's been here as long as Matt, but he was the first, like the first employee of this program, really made it possible. I ran into Dorsey on the street in 2010. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm thinking about doing a show. And he's like, I'll help you. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't have any money to pay you, really. I mean, anything that he's like, I'll do it. And he helped basically get the show off the ground. But also Isaac and Julie, who runs all our business stuff, and Chris and Maria, and then, of course, Jacob and Corey, who do the AM Quickie. And as always, Kyle, who none of this would exist without Kyle whatsoever. Because before I even ran into Dorsey, Kyle had said, I'll set up the tech for you, and made it possible. And I want to thank Matt Binder and Brandon Sutton, who are regularly on the program. And of course, Old Kelly, appreciate the work she does, like helping us with advertising. But everybody who makes this show possible, just can't thank you enough. And, 2025, it's going to be difficult. We got a difficult 4 years ahead of us. But we're going to try and find wins when we can. And at least, at the very least, account for what is happening.
I just want to also shout out our YouTube and our Twitch mods who do a lot of great work for us. They are unheralded, unsung heroes of our online space.
100%. I met Serious Business on the cruise.
That's right. And of course our mods and our folks from the Discord as well.
Yep.
Yeah. All right.
Emma.
ESPN, Bradley and I gave our picks. Last of the year, youtube.com/ESPN show.
And on Left Reckoning, the algorithm's been very kind to Left Reckoning. We shot past 40,000 subs. It'd be nice to get to closer to 50. Matt Sittman of Know Your Enemy on Tuesday talking about Trump's victory and sort of where we are. And we also talk about AI. Some fun interviews with Nathan Robinson coming up and some other folks. And also our Bum Steer of the Year nomination is going to go up on this weekend. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning.
All right.
Juice for Jesus says, the last clip I saw, Sam Destroys Tim Pool Toilet, was pretty algorithmically friendly title for sure. Well, I just want to say my point was is that I did not destroy his toilet for the sake of the algorithm.
Yeah, he didn't have to consult the algorithm to do any of that.
That was completely organic.
That's in the sad algorithm.
No, exactly. Now, Dorsey may have capitalized on that. He's an opportunist. But I can assure you, that was not what was on my mind. What was on my mind at that time was like, what kind of damage can I do? What's the worst damage I can do?
You know,
to this
people
facility?
Are just waiting to hear more about this event and what was on your mind on that front.
That was it.
And what was about happening behind the scenes.
Yeah. Can you tell us about like the texture or like you want to get a little more explicit?
Jesus, Emma, you really missed the point of this.
It'd be funny to do a behind the scenes video. And it's just,
you know what?
Like,
I'll tell you something. There's nothing.
Point up at the stall.
There is nothing I regret more. Than not Instagramming that live or YouTube live-ing that and TikTok.
Well, next time you go down.
Oh there. My God.
God, I need to hang out
with
women more.
It's going
to be the Nashville. Do you understand? Like, our TikTok channel would be so different right now if I had just like shot myself and like, hey, I'm in Tim Pool's, bathroom, sweet toilet, or at least it was.
Show off the bidet part.
Yep.
Yeah, plumbing's probably going to be better in Nashville.
Just a huge mistake on my part. Missed opportunity. That's a generational problem. Because if I was younger, I would have had the presence of mind to do that.
You know, in France, they have a concept called le spirit de l'escalier, which means the spirit of the staircase or staircase wit, which is things you come up as you're leaving someplace and you're on the staircase.
Yeah, I should have
said that.
Yeah.
Le spirit toilette.
Should have did a bathroom selfie.
Staircase wit.
Yep.
Taking a picture of your shit. That's like what we're at here.
You know, listen, you know who was very into that was Dali. Salvador Dali. We don't need to get in. We don't need to get into that.
Why do you?
He had a poop journal, folks. Again, have a happy holiday and happy New Year's. We're just going to take a quick break. We'll be back with the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America. You. Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Let's just catch up with this, and then we will go for it. I'm just looking at these things here. This is the way that the... I don't know what clip this is. Mangione, the guy who ostensibly killed the CEO of United Health, was extradited to New York. And we're going to show you a picture of this. I mean, this is obviously a made-for-television event. And media, we have a clip. We have, I don't know if we have video. Do we have video or just this picture? We don't need the video. This gets it. Look at this video, this picture.
It's crazy.
It is unclear to me what it is that New York City, or Eric Adams is trying to project. Now you can see Eric Adams is over, Mangione. I guess it's his
right shoulder.
And we should say, I don't think that they're in equally hot water, but in terms of the crime, obviously the law, But the fact is that Eric Adams is also indicted. He is being investigated himself.
Right.
And
maybe that's why they needed all the security.
And yeah, like, who is it for? Are they perp walking Eric Adams or this other guy? Like, I get it. I just don't understand what's going on. If they expect an attack to somehow spring this guy, and that's why they have, you know, SWAT teams with, semi-automatic weapons guarding him, and they've all got Kevlar vests on, why don't they have a Kevlar vest on him?
Well, you know why. I mean, this is a show of force. This is an intimidation display, in my view. And I think it's going to have the reverse effect. I think most people...
It's making him a folk hero.
Well, it already is, kind of. And this is just exacerbates it the more that they choose to show resistance to it or treat him like he's like Bin Laden or something.
Put that picture up on the right. This is funny. Somebody compared this to that one. Yeah.
The Superman thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That apparently happened in...
They're filming. That's them filming the new one, I think, actually.
Okay. That's in a DC comic, Superman, also held by more or less the same amount of guys. Now, to be fair, the New York City police were dressed in New York City police gear and not in camo. But more or less the same picture. It's absurd. Here is Jamie Peck, formerly of the Majority Report, formerly of the Antifada. Now, the name of her show is the...
I want to get it right. Party... One second. I'll get that right.
Party Girls?
Yes. I think so.
And she was on Chris Cuomo's program, and I think she did a pretty good job. As far as I can tell, and I don't know what the motivations of people donating to this guy's, criminal defense fund are. I suspect this guy has plenty of money to mount a defense. But the value, it seems to me, of doing this, and I imagine, this is what Jamie and the organizers of this fund are doing, is trying to continue the conversation that was clearly started about healthcare. We haven't talked about healthcare as a country in ages.
I mean, I think a lot of Democrats treated the Affordable Care Act as the end-all be-all and the solving of this issue.
Now we just got to maintain it.
But we do know, and that was what Kamala Harris was running on. And what's unfortunate is that, you know, the knock-on effect of funneling more and more people into the private health insurance system, the upshot is that, like, more people are insured, and that's a good thing. But it also allows for these health insurers to they are now banned from with the patient protection part for denying you for a pre-existing condition. But the incentive to deny you care is still there because they make more money if you're just paying insurance and they don't have to pay for your care. So it's just more people in that system, and they found other ways to get around it. And so people still think it's broken, and the Harris campaign, the Democrats haven't tapped into it at all.
The thing I find fascinating about this is, like, obviously, Jamie's fund is about getting this conversation into the mainstream. But equally as obvious is Chris Cuomo's having somebody on to talk about this is just his way of getting clicks. So they're both doing it for, sort of like as publicity stunts, except for one person here is doing it the publicity stunt so that people get health care. And the other one is doing it so that he can expand his house on,
suck
the Hamptons
up to CEOs
or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Jamie Peck joins us now. Thank you for taking the opportunity.
Thank you for having me.
Help me understand. Why is it a beautiful thing? Why do you support him assassinating another human being in cold blood?
So I was definitely joking a little bit, obviously drawing a comparison between what Donald Trump said about himself and the sort of explosion, this appetite, this excitement for the conversation that Luigi Mangione started. But I do think to call this an act of terrorism is an insult to the intelligence of the American people. Terrorism is something designed to strike fear into the hearts of non-combatant civilians, right? The general population. Nobody but a tiny class of CEOs has been made to live in fear by Luigi's actions, but nearly everybody knows what it's like to live in fear of having a necessary medical claim denied, the fear of having your life ruined or potentially ended by a stack of medical bills. And I think in a system with so much violence that's directed from the top down, it should come as no surprise when violence begins to boomerang back from the bottom up onto the 1%. Also, I would like to remind you on the subject of terrorism, nearly 3,000 Americans lost their lives on 9/11, right? This is the largest terrorist attack this country has ever seen. An estimated 190,000 people are murdered each year by our broken healthcare system. That is the equivalent of 52 9/11s worth of deaths every year. Every single week, another 9/11 happens. So I got to ask, who is the more prolific terrorist in this equation?
Well, first of all, as you may know, Jamie, terrorism is a specific legal standard, right? There's no question that Luigi did what he did in furtherance of a political agenda. He said it, okay? So I don't see this as a question of fact or law. It's about the policy behind it. What I don't understand, and you know, you are somebody who in your positions is constantly trying to embrace the humanity of situations, right? I've been looking at why you support what you do with what's happening in the Middle East conflict. To me, this seems to be anathema to this. You know,
can you pause
nothing within a system.
I just want to make this point because that was generous. That was nice of him. But when he talks about her humanity in this sense, he's betraying that, or I don't know what his opinions are, but I doubt that he is a principled anti-killing human being. There are like a very small number of people on this planet that are in principle just saying, I keep bringing this up, this example, Sister Helen Prejean, who is an anti-death penalty advocate, right? That's like the class of person who is in principled anti-violence. The question for a 99% of the population, and specifically if you're in media or politics, is what violence are you against? And is it the stuff that you express outrage over, is it when violence is directed upward or is it when violence is directed downward? And based on the reaction to this killing of the healthcare CEO, you can tell a lot about people's politics, especially if they were justifying Daniel Penny's killing of Jordan Neely on the subway. So I just want to point that out because he's trying to paint Jamie as this extremist in her opinions on this front and saying this is contrary to her humanity. But unless you have a principled anti-killing position, you can't make that case.
This seems to be anathema to this. You know, nothing within a system gets changed by violence. How can you expect? Yeah, we're having a conversation, but we're not having the right one because the healthcare industry now has high ground because they've been victimized.
Pause it for a second. He can't possibly believe that the healthcare industry has the moral high ground.
Is that what they're all feeling these days?
What's really fascinating about this, there's two things fascinating about this. And like I say, it's very helpful that she's on there. It's extending the conversation. It's making people think about it. But it is fascinating to watch this like sector of the media and the way that like it is. It's tabloid. It's tabloid stuff. But it is fascinating how they're, you know, like even to sort of like generate a story here, the idea that somehow the health insurance industry, like how does that manifest itself?
And what
are there people doing vigils now out in front of like health CEOs houses, like we've got you, no, over our dead body.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that this is going to change things, but how does Chris Cuomo suggest that we get rid of the private health insurance industry? What is potent these days? Like I think the government needs to end that industry entirely by having a public
100%. Of course.
Public health insurance.
Decommodify.
Yeah. Do we want to hear her response?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Our industry now has high ground because they've been victimized by this chooch. This isn't how we get insurance to be better.
Chooch.
By putting a bullet in somebody's head. Why would you get behind that?
Bless you.
Now, I've never advocated violence as a tactic for change coming from
you're celebrating the guy.
People that I organize with. This was a lone wolf act of violence on the part of Luigi Mangione, and it seems to have started a huge conversation among everybody about the violence, the death, and the murder caused by this broken healthcare system. Again, one 9/11 every single week indefinitely until someone puts a stop to this madness. So we are here really to advocate for the thousands and thousands of people who have spoken up against an unjust and violent healthcare system, which is not
a fact
of nature.
Jamie, that's 100% fine. And by the way,
pause it. I love it how he's like the way that he's. This is such a like. This is honestly. I wonder if this like you know if this is like the type of like phone call that Jamie would get like from her parents. Like, well, I'm not saying I agree. I'm not saying I agree with that. Everybody should have health care. It's fine for you to believe that, and it's fine.
Yeah.
It's just your mother and I are concerned that you are going out and like our neighbors came by
right.
and said, like, what is Jamie doing?
Right. Right.
Yeah. And Jamie's exactly right. Like, this is not something any leftist groups from like the more anarchist to all the way to communists. They don't say, let's go do individual violence typically. Like, and nobody says John Brown, there is our model for political action. But if you conversely say John Brown, colon terrorist, people are going to raise an eyebrow at you and thinking you may be a neo-Confederate.
How about Nelson Mandela, terrorist, who was on the terrorist watch list until 2008? Chris Cuomo ready to have that conversation about why that was the case.
But Likud.
And it, right. Well, that's a whole nother can of worms. But like the point there is like even Mandela talked about how violence might be necessary to create change. But you wouldn't have that kind of nuanced conversation about the role of violence in politics on this network because he's trying to sensationalize it and have her on there. So like a boomer audience is like, see, the kids these days, they don't get it. They're all crazy. And that's the role of what this is.
When the crazy thing is that we accept a system that is so brutal every day and we look like we're going to continue it through another term.
All right, let's play just a little bit more.
That's 100% fine. And by the way, it's not new, okay? People have been crusading against insurance companies, but there's no question we haven't gotten changes to the system that are necessary. No question. You're talking to one of them right now. I look this old because I am old, and I've been covering that system for over 25 years, and almost never positively. But you're raising money for this guy's legal defense. If that isn't supporting what
pause
he did...
Pause it for 1 second. I just don't mean to interrupt here, but again, but that butt is doing a big thing. Like, Jamie, there has been absolutely no progress on this for 25 years. Believe me, I'm old. I've seen it. But, I mean, why should you do this, take this opportunity to draw people's attention to it?
Even if you had a problem with Mangione's actions and wanted to condemn it in the harshest terms, you'd still also say maybe the state using terrorism charges and stacking up on that might be a bad precedent for the future going forward.
Oh, 100%. And look, the bottom line is the real story is the about this, in my mind, is the way that the public has largely reacted to it. The real question here isn't why would you raise money for this and provide yourself an opportunity to talk about what the real issue is, that being healthcare. The real question is like, whoa, what have people missed? That they didn't realize there was this level of anger out there. All right, just continue.
Money for this guy's legal defense. If that isn't supporting what he did, I don't know what would be. And again, as somebody who says what my interest is in seeing people treated humanely, you're raising money for exactly the opposite. I don't get the hypocrisy.
Well, I think everybody is entitled to a fair trial. including Luigi Mangione. And as we know,
he doesn't need your money.
Access to a fair trial is actually quite tiered based on how many resources a person has access to. What?
He's got access. You see who his lawyer is? She ain't working pro bono. I promise you that.
I don't know about that.
Well, we have not heard yet as to whether or not Luigi is going to accept these funds. If he doesn't need them for whatever reason, they're going to be distributed to other people who are facing political charges. But I think in this country, money is a form of speech.
Oh, no, listen, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm not saying you can't do it, Jamie. I'm saying, why would you do it? You have the right to do it. I'm saying, why is it right? Why don't you take the money and give it to people who've gotten screwed by insurance companies?
I think I need to refocus once again onto the murder and the violence inherent in this system that so many people all across the political spectrum, across lines of political difference, conservatives, liberals, Democrats, and Republicans
all
excited and energized.
Raise money for
them.
I think we've got enough.
We already played this, but this is what Cuomo's doing. You said like it's like her talking to one of her parents. This is exactly this comedy thing here of this kid getting into his car with his mom.
And, oh, yes.
And his mom's reaction is exactly what Cuomo's was.
We played this before, Sam. It's pretty great. So this is before he got caught.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the mom doesn't believe what catches on what he's doing late, right?
Yeah.
Hello, Momsy. How are you doing?
Jay, go back. Change. Uh-uh. No green jacket, no hood. This is serious now. A lot of people have been DMing me, messaging me. You have to go back and change. This is not funny. Are you listening to me? This is not a funny situation. Please listen to me. Jake. Oh, my God.
What?
What don't you understand?
Oh, my God.
It's
let him live.
Crime. You need to go home and change.
The person that it was done to did a lot worse, okay? To the entire country.
I'm not negating
to the
that.
Entire
I
country.
I agree with you.
I agree.
He's doing that right there. Held it like that. That's what he's doing.
Because it was that's what they had was that shot.
But that is honestly, that's what
I agree with you, but right.
I'm not negating that, but just like slow your roll a little bit.
And that's the energy there.
Good for Jamie. That came off well, I think. And
agreed.
Gets the message out there. I wish it was on a bigger platform. It would have been funny to see that. Like, you know, I don't know. Maybe News Nation.
Doing their best.
If the people watch that, they probably get more viewers than we do. And they were probably really shocked by it. Actually, that's the thing. You go into that situation, and it's really. That's the formula there. These young people, they're not getting it. Someone said, before you guys leave, please talk about Tim Pool crying over Hassan. What's that? Do we have that? Okay.
I haven't seen this.
What should we do here?
I'll
read some IMs while you decide what we should which clip.
Okay.
Please interview Zohan Mamdani running for mayor in New York City on socialist platforms. Yeah, I was talking to on the Nation Cruise, actually. I was talking to someone who's a friend of his, and maybe we will do that. But, you know, we don't generally get too deep into New York City politics or try not to, but I think you know, it's also who the mayor of New York City has implications. We've definitely seen that with Eric Adams. That's for sure.
Mamdani, for such a young guy, seems very natural politician.
And honestly, I do think that the lack Eric Adams and Hochul and the lack of responsiveness of Democrats in urban areas that like where we saw that slide towards Donald Trump, it's really important for the Democratic Party more broadly for their brand for Democrats to change course, especially in these big cities. I don't know. I mean,
here is War on Santa. Sam, consider, but for one person today, we could be celebrating President Sanders' second and final term, reading stories about the end of school and medical debt, the success of Medicare for All, a $30 minimum wage, the peace agreement between Iran and Israel, in which Palestinians receive full citizenship and reparations, in the seventh consecutive year of decreases of Pentagon spending. Thanks, Obama. Listen, I would say none of what you were talking about would have happened necessarily. I think we've been in a very different place, and it's quite possible that Sanders would have won second term, but you have to remember that Sanders gets into that. Folks like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema on day one are fighting against him.
And Bernie himself.
And then there's probably another half a dozen people who are doing that. On the Democratic side.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not even talking the Republican side. Who knows? It would have been a different trajectory. And I think it would have been a significantly better one. And our politics would be much better shape as opposed to like where we are now in this sort of miasma. We should not engage in magical thinking. And we should also be aware that it's not just one person in terms of Obama. When you go into this situation, you need to anticipate that if Bernie represents some significant change, not just for the country, but for the Democratic Party, there are going to be people who are not going to want that change. I mean, that's like definitional, right? Like, who knows what would happen if COVID hadn't happened. I mean, certainly Sanders was on his back. You know, the campaign was in trouble when COVID hit because of Super Tuesday. But it may have been a very different situation. And frankly, who knows if Trump would have, if there's no COVID, who knows that whether Bernie could have beaten Trump in that situation? It's hard to know. I mean, I don't think it's helpful for that. I do think it's helpful to understand that this is what you're up against in the context of a Democratic Party. We can blame Warren's political instincts to some extent, but we can also blame Sanders' political instincts in not anticipating where Warren would be positioned. I mean, you know, in the end, Warren got at least something out of that campaign. Sanders did too. Warren got the antitrust stuff. Sanders got the labor stuff. Eliminate one of those two from the race, and you do not see that in the Biden administration, as far as I can tell. And I suspect, based upon the reporting of where Biden's head was, it was like, I promised Bernie this, and he was good, and this for Warren. Okay, take care of it. And then Ron Klain goes off and says, send me a list of personnel to both of them. I mean, I'm sure it was a little bit more complicated than that, but maybe not that much more. And, running for president involves like a level of sophistication about politics that, it's hard to come by in some ways, particularly if you also have a set of ideology that isn't necessarily palatable to a big chunk of that party that you're, that may be the plurality of that party even. So I don't know. Just be careful of like,
I mean, Bernie himself said that the job would start if he got into office.
Yeah.
Like that would, when the hard part happens.
Frankly. 100%. KNYC, oh, I did that. Shrimpphonic, big props to all the volunteer members of this community, the mods who keep the YouTube chat and Discord usable. Indeed. Hack all things. Say poggers, Sam. Poggers. F YouTube. Twitch is the better stream. Only second to the Rumble stream. Give us Timmy Pool clip. It's poggers. El Conniption. Hey, MR crew, AOC invoking Vietnam in comparison to Gaza makes me want to ask, Was there a racist dehumanizing component to the public sentiment around Vietnam the way there is with Gaza? Oh, my God.
The racism about Vietnam.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, there was some of it.
Google a word that starts with goo.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even remember what they called Jane Fonda for standing up.
Oh, Hanoi Jane.
Right. But I guess that.
But I mean, the racism was oh, of course.
To the max. They would shock us today.
Oh, of course. Of course. Between the 101 and the 5. Dude, everyone's miscalculated AOC, especially the left. She's really strategically powerful. I think, she's a politician. If she makes the decision to be a politician, she's going to have to make these assessments. We can agree or disagree, but in the absence of making those assessments, she's not serious about trying to get power. That's just the bottom line. It is, you can definitely have a career in the House just getting up and, being a blowhard. Anthony Weiner was like that. Anthony Weiner, as he spoke, he was on the right side of, I don't know if everything, but as far as what you can remember, he was, because he would get up there and he would showboat. But he wasn't going anywhere in Congress. He did nothing. He didn't move the needle at all. When you're particularly in the House, you know, the bully pulpit has a lot more to do, I think, when you're, a president. But if you're the bully pulpit has you need to be on committees and you need to have influence over what the committee's looking at. And that's the way it works in the House. And again, I don't necessarily agree with the choices that. Where what fights that she does or does not choose to fight for, you know, maybe, but this I have a feeling it's probably marginal cases. But the idea that she has a theory that there are material, and it was interesting, at least on that anti-Semitism language, where she was like, if there was something that was operational, I would have voted against it.
She all but said why she voted for that, which was a calculation.
This is a calculation.
Yeah.
This is not a fight that I can win and have influence over. So I'm going to cede it. You know, it's the difference between, I guess, you know, boxing and just going in and flailing your arms around.
Yeah. I mean, I'm somebody who thinks that maybe like Rashida Tlaib's approach, I really like that. I think it's closer to movements. But I think like the folks that want AOC to do a different strategy, it's like we need different politicians and more people to
100%.
Take power and try these different strategies out rather than making sure each one does the strategically
if
right
I'm
thing.
If I'm Tlaib, I want AOC to get as powerful as she can in Congress because Tlaib knows that that's going to help her in some fashion.
Exactly. And then you have someone like Ilhan Omar who quietly, she's the progressive whip and she makes change and she's in, you know, a semblance of a leadership position as well. And that gets done a little bit more quietly, which is part of her strength. And part of AOC's strength is her ability to communicate with the public.
Yeah. And I'll just say Robin for Minneapolis, independent socialist in Minneapolis City Council. I think like from that base of power, you can make more critiques of along these measures. But I also say Robin works with Democrats because that's just kind of what politics are on this thing now. So like, again, you can have critiques, but I think like an actual model of somebody that is actually doing the thing that you want rather than just a negative critique saying this is nothing. It's not really worth a whole lot, frankly. It's really cheap to do. Learning how to win power and organize your community, that makes those sorts of critiques a little bit more credible.
All right, let's talk about this Morning Joe thing. This is just so dumb. This is all just part of the dumb thing. This is why I also like the whole notion of President Musk. I get it. But let's, you know, there's a sense of like, you know, this the sort of the Lincoln Project mentality. which is if we get under Trump's skin, like we need to progress past this because the problem is not Donald Trump and the problem is not Elon Musk. By saying President Trump, all you're doing is trying to get under Donald Trump's skin. By saying the Republicans are owned by billionaires, that the billionaire sneezes and the Republicans run, you know, are a piece of tissue or whatever it is, whatever clever thing you need to come up with. But this dynamic, Republicans are the problem. Oligarchy is the problem. Not whether Trump or Musk is the oligarch. It's masturbatory. It is literally just like it's like a bubble bath for a certain segment of the population. That's great, but we need something more than a bubble bath. This is a perfect example of it. These two bubble bathers here, and let's also be clear, just even the way that like these people are so compromised, even with their sort of like performance that they did over the course of the. Really, when they fell out of favor with Donald Trump, it was all just a performance. This is
and sucking up to Biden. I don't know if there's one news show that's more responsible for the horror show that we're about to see than Morning Joe in and of itself, which told Biden some bedtime stories for a clearly addled man that if they were close with him, they probably were aware of this about how he could win with an approval rating, which in a way that was historically unprecedented. And when there were concerns about his acuity going back to 2019. So thanks to these guys, we're in part in the situation that we're in.
And here they are, like, this is just so blinkered. Go ahead.
They have been saying for weeks now, no retribution. He's not going to do retribution. We don't have time for retribution. I mean, this sort of talk early on, it's bad for everybody. It's
pause
bad
it for
the
a second.
House
now, pause
Republican.
It, pause it. Now, this is what's just so completely nauseating. They're talking about, investigating Liz Cheney because of her role on the J6 committee. I can't even remember.
They made her the star of the January 6th committee when it could have been a Democrat.
They made her the star of it. And apparently she met with some, some whistleblower before the committee, whatever it was. But Scarborough is... The way that he pitches this, like, this is bad for everybody. This is his, like, this is them trying to be a Trump whisperer. We're in your corner. Go ahead.
Early on, it's bad for everybody. It's bad for the House Republicans. It's bad for Donald Trump. It's bad for, the markets. I mean, this is what we've been talking about. Retribution blew back on Democrats through the years. Donald Trump will probably be the first to say that he got elected in part because he was sitting at a criminal defendant's table this summer, made him a martyr. You put Liz Cheney there, or you even talk about it. You even talk about it. And you put out these stupid reports that this House subcommittee has put out. You're making her a martyr. You're making her bigger.
Pause it. Right there on that guy's face. That is the face of a guy who's thinking, what the hell are you talking about? How am I going to respond to this in a way that's not going to get me disinvited from the show? Liz Cheney's career is over.
Yep.
It's over. Donald Trump did not become president because he was in a courtroom for those things. The only thing that did is it kept him from being out in the public and prevented him from having to actually take positions that may have been detrimental to him before. The percentage of people that came out and voted for Donald Trump because he was aggrieved was always going to be 100%, and it was never like it's just an absurd theory. And then from what public position is Liz Cheney going to
be a martyr?
She was useless to the Democrats.
Yeah.
Useless to the Republicans. These guys are just holding on. It's really, they're talking about themselves that they're afraid of being disempowered. It's absurd.
In terms of Liz Cheney's influence, what happens when you multiply zero by many times over in terms of how strong this is going to make her? It's still going to be zero because no one outside of the DC Beltway. I've never seen a more DC Beltway focused conversation. No one cares. And anybody that already knew that Liz Cheney was in opposition to Donald Trump trying to overturn the election, and people who were going to vote for Kamala Harris, that Venn diagram is a circle. And then everyone else that heard the name Cheney ended up associating it with, yeah, wasn't that the guy that helped kill like hundreds of thousands of Muslims? And isn't Biden kind of doing that right now? At least like slaughtering a lot in Gaza? That's the connection that was made. But they don't even think like that because their Beltway brain is so like both self-interested in their own narrative, because if Liz Cheney's politics are affirmed, so is Joe Scarborough's. And if that kind of political future exists for a figure like Liz Cheney, they're relevant again. Right now, they're tanking in the ratings because they did resistance liberalism and they built up the myth of Joe Biden. And both of those two things have kind of just dissipated. I mean, the myth of Joe Biden is the myth.
The idea that he's sitting there and this isn't, and let's, this is not analytical. There's no data to support this at all. Liz Cheney's, I would suggest that the idea that they're going to prosecute Liz Cheney, and they won't, but the idea that they would, has moved her approval rating, whatever it is, not 1 point. This is, they're trying to be prescriptive to suck up to Trump.
Yeah.
This is the way, like, Trump, we have your best interests in mind. You shouldn't do this. And just coincidentally, also, if you don't do this to Liz Cheney, they won't come after us. I mean, that's what's going on here.
Right.
Like the sort of like this is sort of layers of self-interest on this. And it is such a disservice. It's so
It's supposed to be
bizarro.
News. This
it's
is so supposed bizarro. To be news.
So bizarre.
Have a personal blog. Talk about it with your therapist. They can afford one. If you're personally concerned about your future and your career, that is for the private, like your private conversation. Let's not make this, you know, what something that's not.
All right, let's move over to this. We've got people on the IM screaming about this clip. I haven't seen it, but this is when was Poole doing this?
Yesterday?
This is yesterday or the day before. I don't know what's going on. I guess it's cold in his studio. Or maybe they turned off the heat in there because he's moving to Nashville. Is he moving to Nashville? Is that definitely happening? Or are they, have they?
I saw that implied, but you know, who knows? Maybe
who knows? He just built his skateboard park there.
That's got to be heartbreaking for him. It's a little boy's dream.
It is. He's got his Neverland Ranch, and he'll have to leave it. I mean, and I wonder if he writes into the contract, if he goes to Daily Wire, that anybody who works on a show has to watch him skateboard for 20 minutes a day. But here is, this is
Tim Pool.
He's reacting to a Fox News report that a Kamala Harris staffer was like, we need more Hassan Pikers in the Democratic media sphere. And so he's sort of like, how do we counteract that if that's actually the tack that they choose to take?
That's spoiler alert. That's not going to be the tack they choose to take.
And I'll just make one note. Tim Pool, the Daily Wire was apparently a silent partner in his operation for a few months now.
Do we know this for sure? Or
I can look up the source on that. But I'll get back to that after this clip then, if that's right. But I'll.
But here he is commenting on. Brett Cooper being let go from the Daily Wire, and he's just saying, I assume Brent wanted more money. Daily Wire didn't want to pay more. Impasse. I don't get why anybody would be mad. It's not like Brett can't keep doing videos. Now, I wonder if he had some inside information here and was just running cover for potentially maybe his existing employer or whatnot. I mean, he was very cagey. You'll recall when I asked him about the tenant money or from Edward Gagarin, the Russian money that he was getting, if he had any other license deals, and he was all over the place. I mean, the jibber jabber coming from him was amazing.
Yeah.
He kept implying that there were people negotiating with him 2 years ago when he was talking to Tenet, and that they're still negotiating with him, or that the deal was there. And then he claims that like he had done a license deal for his Tim Pool show on National Geographic. And I think that was more like he probably was like a stringer and shot some footage for them. Very strange. But let's hear what he's saying here.
Democrats calling for more Hassan Pikers. I'm going to reiterate, Brett Cooper launching her own channel is a good thing. Certainly, you wanted her to retain the
massive market. Pause it for a sec. Why does she have to launch her own channel? Couldn't the Daily Wire give the channel that she's built to her?
She built the channel, and now the capitalists get to own it. And Tim thinks it's good that she at least gets to make videos on her own now?
A lot of media companies. A lot of media companies do that. So if you're questioning, like, why hasn't this person left this company or X, Y, or Z? Sometimes the corporation that owns like a bunch of these channels contractually refuses to let people out of them. And this is across the media space and across ideology.
Yeah, the only time I recall that is like when Cenk let Jimmy Dore walk away with TYT Comedy. And I think they probably learned their lesson that they don't want to do that for any of their people there. That's my guess.
That's my guess,
too. It was a nice one for Jimmy, though, Jimmy, to take TYT Comedy, which is still what the, if you search youtube.com/TYT Comedy, still where it still goes to his channel.
And the issues at play, and where we go media-wise. With the Democrats calling for more Hassan Pikers, I'm going to reiterate, Brett Cooper launching her own channel is a good thing.
An army.
Certainly, you wanted her to retain the massive marketing efforts of the Daily Wire. She's not going to, but I think she'll be all right. Brett Reagan, replacing Brett, is going to get the massive infrastructure of the Daily Wire. Is that what people are mad? Like, honest question for those in the comments. Is the issue that the Daily Wire spends a ton of money promoting and building up this channel and you want Brett to have that capability? I think she's going to find a way. Having another Reagan is really good. It's really annoying how people just want Daily Wire to be evil. I really just don't like the people who make their whole identity Israel. Guys, you can criticize the Daily Wire, you criticize Israel. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the people who are obsessed with
If somebody's a little bit worried about deporting his own audience over there. Now, again, it's rumors. It has not been. It has not happened. It was rumored to be in play, but I wonder if he's starting to realize, like, his audience is like, I don't want to be associated with the Daily Wire. I don't want to give money, because honestly, like, whatever the relationship would be between Tim Pool and the Daily Wire, understand, both parties do it because it's mutually beneficial to them. So if you're giving money to Tim Pool or views to Tim Pool, you're giving money and views to the Daily Wire.
Hey, look, the money that they don't have to pay Brett Cooper to bring her back to her channel, her own channel, for the next year is money that they can give Tim Pool to move to Nashville. But also, it's Meteorite News that made the allegation. Pool additionally has already had the Daily Wire as a silent minority partner in Timcast for months. So I'd be interesting to see more clarification on that.
Hmm.
Criticize the Daily Wire, you criticize Israel. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the people who are obsessed with nothing but Israel and criticize Daily Wire in that vein. Okay.
The Zionists are the ones obsessed with Israel. The people that are obsessed with Israel's actions are the ones trying to prevent genocide. So anyway.
But Israel and criticize Daily Wire in that vein. Okay. If you're critical of Daily Wire, you're allowed to be. Not saying that. But we need more people in the space. We need more investment. We need, they're outright saying they want more Hassan.
What about more investment in Brett?
But who's the we? Who's the we?
Tim's getting the more investment, I think.
No, but who's the we? I thought Tim was a moderate. I mean, the Daily Wire is an unabashed right-wing
network.
Who's the we he keeps talking about? We need more in this infrastructure. Is he talking about our show? Is he advocating for us to get some money from the Mercers or from Miriam Adelson or from some right wing organization? Who, from Slack? What's that guy's, David Sachs or whatever?
Peter Thiel.
I mean, who is the we here? He seems to be fully identifying as of the right at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he has some positions that are heterodox within that right wing thing. He may not, have a litmus test as to Israel, or he may sort of like say, well, I actually believe in some, that even though he has said publicly, in fact, multiple times in front of my face, that he feels that if you've been raped and you don't want to expose yourself to and you don't get a timely rape kit test, which we know that rape kits sit unexamined all the time, even if they're taken, and you're not able to prosecute your rapist, then you deserve to be impregnated and forced to give birth to that rapist body. I mean, that rapist, a child. That's, you know, he does believe in some exception, I guess, that if you go and successfully prosecute a rapist, then you don't have to have their child. So that's his, you know, their abortion
reward.
Yeah, right. That's their his exception to abortion, which I don't know if that exists at the Daily Wire. Maybe they do or don't believe that. But this guy's a right winger. That's his project. He may be heterodox. He may skateboard, but he is a right winger. He's identifying himself that way. Go ahead.
Not saying that. But we need more people in the space. We need more investment. We need, they're outright saying they want more Hassan Pikers. Well, we want more Brett Coopers. We want more people who are going to be calling out the lies, the cheating, and the stealing. And if we don't focus on what, like Reagan and Brett are of comparable cultural worldview, despite any personal drama or beef that people may perceive. I don't know. I don't care. What we don't want is more Hassan Pikers. Hassan's welcome to come on the show and debate anytime. He's going to stand by his ideas, but...
We want more Brett Coopers, and a Reagan and a Brett are comparable. I'll say from a capitalist perspective, one of them was asking for more money, and Reagan, the one who's going to take over the position, was going to take less. And this is why, like, in our press, this is actually a huge problem, is experienced people who need to support families get filtered through the press and replaced by interns. Ben Rhodes, Obama foreign policy guy, commented on this during the Obama administration, said none of these reporters know what the fuck history is. They have no idea what like happened in South America, Central America. They don't know what we're talking about. So I'm talking to kids. That's not only ideological, that's money saving by our press.
Right.
100%.
Right.
If Democrats start reinforcing that space, we get crushed. They're going to pull in. Disney's going to have $1 billion in revenue, and they're going to say, let's allocate $500 million towards owning the podcast space. They already largely control a lot of it. And while they come out and say conservatives are well-funded and organized, that's just not true. The majority of these people who are quote-unquote conservative, independent, the biggest names in the space, largely independent.
Pause it.
No big
incidentally,
networks.
Tim Pool will tell you that he's independent after being paid millions of dollars over the past 2 years from just some, you know, rando. Just some rando.
Joe Rogan has taken money from Disney, Fox, Spotify, and Unilever.
Just some rando is funding me. I'm completely independent. Incidentally, it was like people from The Blaze was the way that he, you know, gave the cover for this, you know, fake Edward Gregorian. Is that, you know, he may be independent, but there's so much money sloshing around there. They're all independent, except from where they get their money from, according to him. Go ahead.
Independent. The biggest names in the space, largely independent. No big networks. Then you look at these other popular podcasts, and they're more likely to have networks and be produced serialized shows coming from the corporate press and legacy media. It's changing. Rumble's doing a great job. Daily Wire's doing a great job. The Blaze, they're there as well.
Rumble, previously known as Cantor Fitzgerald Acquisition Corporation number 6.
Independent!
Isn't the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald Trump's commerce secretary pick?
Yeah, so, you know.
Independent
guys.
You know, everyone's saying, what, you don't think they're doing a great job? The Blaze is doing all right, but they need to do more. You've got these networks, they could do better. So in response to what we're seeing here, as it pertains to NDAs, I want to cover this and highlight this because Candace did respond based on my last post. For those that aren't familiar, I basically said that that Brett leaving the Daily Wire is likely a contract dispute. They didn't come to terms, so she went to do her own channel. So long as she gets good advice and she knows what she's doing, she should be totally fine. I do have concerns about the launching of her channel as of yet. Without any content on it, that could be a big risk as it creates dead subs. I want to stress that because I hope people
right, I mean, I don't care about this. Yeah, okay, stupid. Whatever.
Well, what's fascinating about it to me is if it is the case that he knows that it's a contract dispute because he's getting inside information from the Daily Wire. Like, I wonder, when you sign an NDA like that, it's usually there's a mutual non-disparagement clause to it. And I should say, just full disclosure, I have never produced an NDA that anybody who has worked around me or for me has had to sign at any time.
But a lot of people in media, a lot in media, it's like, I would say more common than it's not.
I was shocked at
how common it is.
100%. Yep. But there's usually a non-disparagement. Usually it works for the employer, but there's usually a non-disparagement. I wonder if Poole spoke out of school and then has to sort of backtrack a little bit because he may have had information that was sort of inside information from the employer. And you're not allowed to do that either.
And he's acting like it's just, oh, I'm just assessing this.
Oh, now he's going to be like, I'm just guessing that she asked for more money, which is weird. That's a weird guess. I wouldn't necessarily have assumed that.
Right.
It could be.
To be fair, I did.
Well, it could be. I mean, look, Candace Owens, was she asking for more money? No, I mean, they had a very public spat. But, you know, a lot of times. But he's assuming that she's asking for more money. And it looks to me like he's doing some repair. That somebody said, Tim, what are you doing? You're not supposed to know that. And he's going out and making a video and larding up all of the video, but basically to make sure that he is out of any type of liability. Now, of course, this is all my opinion. I'm just speculating. Yeah. But I don't have any inside information on this and nothing that certainly could be conceived. It seemed as defamatory because I'm just saying it's speculation on my part. I don't know anybody within the Tim Pool organization that has given me any information about stuff like this.
But if Brett Cooper's lawyer wants to have us testify.
I mean, I don't know. It's quite possible there are people who are privy to what's going on in the Tim Pool organization because there's a lot of dissent there that is brewing because they're a little bit upset and worried that, wait a second, we moved here with my family from, I don't know, a coast, let's say. And settled in this place and I can't get another job and I got to move again for the second time in like a couple of years. Are you kidding me? But who knows? Interesting to see what's going on with that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll see if Tim goes over to the Daily Wire. It's going to really have to change his messaging.
Yeah.
Us, we over at the Daily Wire. I think he might kind of.
He's been doing that for like a year or so.
Yeah, but once you're actually in that stable, I think it's going to be harder to stand out.
It's what we've seen. The luster's off for Jimmy Dore. The luster's off for Dave Rubin. The luster will be off for Tim Pool. Once you've worn out the gimmick of like being a disaffected leftist or whatever Tim would have said, then you're kind of screwed. Because you've got to actually communicate. Like, then they'll just go to the real thing.
Should we do this number 16? There's one.
Well, I got to check.
The you and Kyle that.
I mean, it's not that good.
All right, what else we got?
Oh,
yeah, I guess we should do the War on Christmas. Folks, every year we play this. It's sort of our own holiday tradition here. I think it was about 20 years ago now.
Judging by the screen grab here.
Oh, yeah. No, this is still like 3x4. Like, this is, this was shot on a Pixel Vision. So, around the time of 2004, 2005, Bill O'Reilly and a bunch of the Fox people, and it's lessened over the years. Sometimes you hear squeaks about it, and Donald Trump certainly like still like said, like, you know, when I was president, you could say Merry Christmas. Mm. This is sort of like the old school way of distracting. And you can't believe how much of a distraction it was. They were making up this War on Christmas thing, and it was a way to activate their Christian voters. And to a large extent, I think their Christian voters are all activated now. And so they don't need to do this base of it. They used transphobia to do it. But George Bush was driving people out to, you know, across the country for the 2004 election to vote against marriage equality. And the other thing that was happening was this sort of like scare that there was going to be no more Christmas. And you can look around and see how much Christmas is around you this time of year. In fact, it almost feels less to me a little bit than like
the
normal.
The Cold War on Christmas is being won by
us. I think
us.
Part of it is because supposedly like Thanksgiving was late in the month this year. The third Thursday was like the 28th. As opposed to something like the 23rd or 4th. And so there was like a half a week that was lost. And nevertheless, there was plenty of Christmas 20 years ago. And I had this notion, like, maybe I'll get invited. Maybe there's a way for me to sneak on to Bill O'Reilly and pretend like I am an actual organization fighting the war on Christmas, convince them they should have me on. But I was doing Air America Radio at the time, and it was a little tougher to fake out Fox.
Mm.
And but I got a call just out of the blue to go on CNN to talk about it. And the best thing that happened to me on this, I had basically planned, you know, to take this tact, but they were going to go to the guy from Concerned Women of America, the guy, who was talking about the war on Christmas, but his ear piece was not in just the second before we went live, mm-hmm. or he couldn't hear, and so they decided to go to me first, and that made his job very, very difficult. This is a young Sam Cedar.
Well, Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays, a Christmas tree or a holiday tree? Which should it be? Depends on whom you ask. We've seen controversy, most notably prompted by the White House. It sent out cards, this card, matter of fact, wishing a holiday season of hope and happiness. No mention of Christmas. Some thoughts now on the subject. Sam Teeter hosts the show Majority Report on Air America Radio. Bob Knight is the director of the Culture and Family Institute. It's affiliated with the Christian conservative organization Concerned Women for America. Gentlemen, great to have you with me.
Thanks for having us on.
All right, well, let's start with the holiday card. What do you think, Sam?
Well, listen, you know, as far as the war on Christmas goes, I feel like we should be waging a war on Christmas. I mean, I believe that Christmas, it's almost proven that Christmas has nuclear weapons, can be an imminent threat to this country, that they have operative ties with terrorists, and I believe that we should sacrifice thousands of American lives in pursuit of this war on Christmas. And hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money.
Well, Sam, is it a war on Christmas, a war on Christians, a war on
I was obviously trying to draw a parallel between our involvement in the Iraq War and the war on Christmas. I think that might be obvious to people. And I was not prepared for her not to listen to a single word I say and just ask the next question she had on her piece of paper. So just go back, and you can see, like, I almost dropped character a little bit here, but I go back into it.
Be an imminent threat to this country, that they have operative ties with terrorists, and I believe that we should sacrifice thousands of American lives in pursuit of this war on Christmas, and hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money.
Well, Sam, is it a war on Christmas, a war on Christians, a war on over political correctness, or just a lot of people with way too much time on their hands?
Well, I would say probably, if I was to be serious about it, too much time on their hands. But I'd like to get back to the operational ties between Santa Claus and Al-Qaeda.
I don't think that exists. Bob?
Well, we have
help
intelligence.
Me out here.
We have intelligence.
You have intel. And where exactly does your intel come from?
Well, we have tortured an elf, and that's it's actually how we got the same information from Al Labee. That's exactly the same way the Bush administration got this info about the operational ties between Al-Qaeda and Saddam.
Okay, Bob Knight. Sam is tying in now the lack of information regarding weapons of mass destruction and moving that into Santa Claus. Help me out here. What's going on? I mean, is this a war on Christians, a war on Christmas? Is this too much political correctness?
Yeah, I want to compliment him on his dry humor, but this is actually a very serious subject because a lot of people are waking up to realize that the war on Christmas is really the culmination
condemnation of a war on faith and the idea that the public square has to be cleansed of any religious expression, particularly Christian religious expression. You know, once showing Happy Holidays was a welcome addition to Merry Christmas, so you wouldn't say the same thing over and over again. But a lot of people now see it as a substitute, and it's very gratuitous at times. And it's actually insulting when you're talking about Christmas Day or a Christmas tree, and you can't bring yourself to use the word for fear of offending someone. In the name of diversity, we're a less free country when that happens.
It's interesting, Sam, pause it for a second.
I mean, do you understand, like, the development of where we are today, right? You can see the aggrievement. You can see the, like, you know, we are a less free country because, I mean, put aside, let's just assume that there were people out there who were like, I'm not going to say the word Christmas. I'm going to say Happy Holidays because I am so, like, adamant on cleansing Christmas from the square. Just assume that there are people out there.
Right.
It is still not an offense to freedom of speech that you say that. Like, it's like they both lie about the premise and then create an aggrievement that doesn't exist, but out of this false premise. This is exactly the formula that we have seen Donald Trump take to the nth degree. And it started in these sort of like right-wing fundamentalist spaces where you had people on the Supreme Court at that time who were trying to develop this notion of religious freedom. Like the idea that, like, if I'm a pharmacist, I don't have to give out birth control because it is an offense to my religion. No. You are licensed to be a pharmacist. Your job is to dispense medicine, not to impose your religious edicts on what we consider medicine. You don't have to be a pharmacist. Nobody's forcing you to be a pharmacist, but this is the system that we have. And this is the way, this was all the sort of the like, this is where this recipe was being developed and perfected back then.
And the way freedom is like a freedom to say happy holiday or the freedom to trade on the Robin Hood app. It's like, is this really what Americans need to be liberated from?
Right.
Go ahead.
We're a less free country when that happens.
It's interesting, Sam, because, I mean, this is a time where, if anything, we want to be even more sensitive to diversity, considering everything that's happening with regard to war on terror. We're learning so much more about different religions, different ethnicities, trying to become more of one versus being segregated.
Yeah, well, Kara, I mean, listen, I would like Bob to tell me who is the person who has been offended by someone saying Merry Christmas to them. I've never met that person. I don't celebrate Christmas, but if someone says Merry Christmas to me and I either think, well, it's a little bit odd. It's like me saying happy birthday to you on my birthday. But, no one cares. But I'll tell you this. As we wage the war on the war on the war on the war on Christmas on our radio show, News Corp, Fox News, those people who have started this entire war on Christmas meme, fake war, they're having a holiday party. President Bush saying happy holidays, Tokyo Rose, Laura Bush, saying happy holidays to her dogs in the video. I'm sure you've seen it. I mean, these are the things that we should be talking about when we are waging this war in Iraq. We should be equating it to the war on Christmas. What else would Bob Knight have an opportunity to do? How else would he get on television if he wasn't pretending to be attacked?
You know, this would be funny, except it is serious to a lot of people who have seen their faith cleansed from the public square systematically.
Well, are you suggesting, Bob, that someone can't celebrate Christmas in America? I mean, tell me about the person who can escape these.
Get a word in here.
Go ahead, Bob.
I'm talking about things like in Ridgeway, Wisconsin, where the school children in the public school were told they couldn't sing Silent Night. So they substituted O Cold Night. You know, I think when you take Jesus out of anything, it gets pretty cold, so it's apt. But it's outrageous.
What?
They had children actually singing a bastardized version of Silent Night.
Well, Bob,
Christmas tree is called holiday trees.
But I don't consider Jesus the Messiah. And so if you're going to ask me to praise Jesus, I'm going to be a little offended. I don't think the singing of the song that you can find other songs to sing. So what about Silent Night?
So because you're offended, none of those other kids can celebrate the great heritage of Christmas.
I'm not the one who said they couldn't
music.
Do that. No, I'm not the
See,
one.
See, you're a Grinch,
but you're trying to
That's
force.
All you are.
Why are you trying to force conversions on people?
Let me ask
you're
you guys.
Forcing
let me,
conversions
yes, you
by
are,
singing
sir.
A Christmas carol.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you guys about the pressure that's been put on stores, for example. American Family Association called for the boycott of Target stores the weekend after Thanksgiving, accusing the chain of banning the phrase Merry Christmas from its stores.
I should also tell you, I am shocked that I'm still on air at this point. Mm. Like, this was supposed to be like a 4-minute segment, but it's clear the producer's going like, oh my God, I can't believe what's going on here. Just keep him on there and ask him more questions. And so this is what's going on. I'm shocked. I just didn't have like a third act for this.
Right. Well, but he gifts you one here, right?
I start getting, go ahead.
Thanksgiving, accusing the chain of banning the phrase Merry Christmas from its stores, a charge that Target denies. Pressure from conservative groups look like it has an impact here. Complaints from the Catholic League. Walmart agreed to create a Christmas page on its website rather than a holiday page. And then Macy's, which is, you know, perhaps more closely associated with Christmas than any other retailer, sent activists a letter touting its use of Merry Christmas in ads and store windows after it was the target of a small-scale boycott last year. I mean, this is pretty amazing, all these boycotts of pressuring all these stores, these businesses, Bob.
Well, these businesses are taking millions and millions of dollars in from Christians in particular and others who celebrate Christmas, giving gifts in the name of the Christmas season. And yet they're so worried about offending people like my opponent here that they don't want to mention the word Christmas. People
Bob,
are sick and tired.
It's the holiday time. I'm not your opponent. I do agree with Bob that I think what should happen is companies should calculate how much money they're getting from people who are celebrating Christmas and provide exactly that much amount of Merry Christmas, because that is exactly how I would want any type of religious holiday to be celebrated.
Would we be having the same argument about Hanukkah? I'm curious.
Would we have the same argument about Hanukkah?
Hanukkah is not the same as Christmas. It's not a major holiday for one thing. And this is the Christmas season. No. That's why billions of dollars are really being spent. It's Christmas.
Well, it's also the winter solstice for a minute. Too.
I don't know, Bob. People might argue that Hanukkah is just as big as Christmas.
Well, I would have to agree with Bob.
I would have to agree with Bob on that. And none of them says Hanukkah is as big
as Christmas. No, Hanukkah is not a high holiday. Our holidays are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which I'm sure Bob has been protesting why there aren't more Yom Kippur sales or Rosh Hashanah sales. Well, I mean, why shouldn't they be, right, Bob?
Well, if that was associated with that holiday, then maybe I would join you, but it never has been.
Bob, have you ever protested Martin Luther King Day not being celebrated? I mean, do you resent when people don't say Happy Martin Luther King Day a month out in advance?
You know what?
Let's put this in perspective.
Bob, I want you to be able to respond, but what's interesting, the CNA USA Today Gallup poll, the question was, is it okay for people to say Merry Christmas? 88% said yes, 11% said no.
Yeah, well, 96% of Americans celebrate Christmas. So why would we care about the 4% that get offended by it? I don't know anybody who'd be offended by someone wishing someone a Merry Christmas.
Why do we care? Why are we making all the changes, Bob? I mean, we do.
Bob, where's the war? Where are the battle lines? I mean, you can tell me that Silent Night can't be sung in one school in Wisconsin.
That's just one example. That's not the totality. What is the totality?
The totality is 80. You brought it up. The totality is 88% of the American population has no problem with it. You don't care about the people who don't celebrate Christmas. Fine. But I don't celebrate Christmas, and I don't care. So why are we wasting everybody's time? It's so that you can fundraise. That's why, Bob.
I'd like to put this in perspective.
Bob, I got to let you have the final thought, Bob.
Okay. You know, when the Nazis moved into Austria,
that is offensive, Bob.
They immediately
removed Christmas
from the schools.
Hold on, Sam. Let Bob make his point. Let Bob make his point. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, Maria Trapp wrote the story of the Trapp Singers that's in The Sound of Music. And she said she sent her kids to school after the Nazis took over, and they came home and said, Mama, we can't say the word Christmas anymore. It's now winter holiday. I think that ought to disturb people
that we're moving toward
that kind of attitude in this country.
The Puritans also outlawed Christmas. The founding fathers of this country would fine you in Massachusetts if you celebrated Christmas at the beginning. So don't talk about Nazis, Bob. I think that's really inappropriate. Why do you have to bring hate to this Christmas and holiday season? That's so sad, Bob.
Well, it's so sad. You ought to read the book yourself.
Well, Bob, it's just sad that you have to raise Nazis when you're talking about Christmas and the holiday season. And we all know that Christmas actually, Tannenbaum, it's a German holiday. Bob, I'm really, really disappointed in you.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but if you can't understand the force of history...
To bring up Nazis, Bob?
I'm not calling you a Nazi.
Oh,
God.
who are you calling a Nazi?
Gentlemen,
who are you calling a Nazi?
We got to let it there. We could probably continue.
You are, sir.
Sam Cedar.
I'm offended.
Air America Radio.
I'm offended.
Bob Knight, Director of Culture and Family Institute. Gentlemen, obviously.
It was really nice of him to give you a Christmas gift in celebration.
That was my favorite.
Invoking Nazis at the end.
Yes, that was my favorite part of that, was just the false like indignation about him calling me a Nazi.
Over the course of 10 minutes, him beginning being the one who's outraged to you being able to flip it where you're the one who's offended is my favorite.
I did like that.
It is a beautiful trajectory. I will admit I've sent that around to people just to give for people to have some familiarity with you.
You harassing the guy like Bob was perfect.
Those
practice
were the days.
For Bob's Burgers.
Yes, yeah. Someone actually just said Noel from San Francisco. I'm only listening. I don't remember this episode where Hugo and Bob argue over Christmas. It's true. And back then too, when I would and not that I don't do that now, but. Back then in particular, when I was like getting excited, my register would raise more than it does now.
Evoking your Bob's Burgers character.
That's correct.
Yes.
Yes. I'm not so much of a voice artist that I can make that much of a distinction. All right, folks. Well, I guess we got to do a couple IMs and then we'll get out of here. We went a little long, but it's the last live show.
We had to get the war on Christmas in.
And that, you can't spend the holidays without that happening. MJS617. Sorry, guys, but I can't get over journalists promoting their Twitter feeds at this moment. That strikes me as a massive contradiction and really exposes the intransigence of certain journalistic outfits right now. Who is promoting their Twitter feed?
I mean, Grimm might have mentioned his Twitter feed. I think as long as that's a network, I'm going to be on it. And I understand people who want to like protest Elon and get off it. Generally speaking, I don't think too highly of the owners of any of the social media platforms that I avail of.
Yeah, I should say that I'm on, you know, like I don't really post very much at all on Twitter anymore. I will retweet occasionally, you know, if there's some stuff that's out there that people find helpful, there needs some amplification. But I'm on Blue Sky, and I'm pulling a lot of stories from Blue Sky, and I encourage people to get on Blue Sky, and I hope that it hits a critical mass. Just the absence of people on Twitter is not going to do it. It really is about people getting onto Blue Sky and providing an alternative that, I have a specific use case for these type of, sites. I mean, part of it is... less and less so to go after right-wing people and drive them nuts. I don't think that's terribly helpful on Twitter anymore because, frankly, it's just so dominated by right-wing. And so many of the right-wing stuff gets promoted that it lost its resonance for there. But for me, I look for news stories. And I still follow some, outlets on both sites. So I don't know. I wouldn't invest too much in that. Let me put it this way. Twitter's going to die or at least become less relevant if Blue Sky or some other alternative, and I haven't found a better one than Blue Sky, does well. It's not going to be because people just leave Twitter. You need to build up Blue Sky, and then it's going to be a much easier thing to do. Cory Doctorow had a great thread on this. That the way that MySpace died was because Facebook developed some API where you could transfer everything from MySpace into Facebook, and you could actually post on both for a while. And so you didn't have to leave one, and you could just go to the other space where all your friends were. Now, he is a little bit Blue Sky shy, because of the nature of the structure of it. And, he's looking for Blue Sky to change a couple of things from a technical perspective that won't allow them to do essentially what Twitter has done, which is trap you in there, trap you by the network effect. But we could talk more about that when we get back.
But we all like Blue Sky and we're on it. So,
yeah.
Bryce from LA, I encourage you to follow everybody. Queen. I'm not sure. Militant apathy. Ryan Clark for president. Clark dunked on Aaron Rodgers and then hung the rim and teabagged him.
Oh my God.
How long before Anna Kasparian is under contract with the Daily Wire? I have no knowledge as to whether that would happen or not. Number 13. The more progressive, the more tactics and cover they provide one another. That's how moderates have become this powerful. Yes, we need to grow progressives in there, and we need to grow their power. And, you know, we'll have more of this in this conversation, but I appreciated the fact that Ocasio-Cortez was willing to sort of like draw the curtain back on her thinking in terms of like, you know, developing power. As a politician, it sort of demystifies some of those things.
Yeah.
And there's only so much you can, right? You can't come out and say like, I am not, I am a complete opponent to the DMFI or, you know, to AIPAC or whatever it is. But I'm willing to, you know, do some meaningless stuff that I perceive as less meaningful. Less meaningful, I think, is probably more accurate. As a way of not being as a way of them preventing me from doing stuff that I think is A, more materially based, both in terms of like literally materially based and in terms of like more operational, and B, things that I think would be would give me, us, the power to influence the other things more. Mizzle, gone on AOC. MR is in the big leagues now. We've had AOC on before.
We've had AOC, we had Bernie, we had Ilhan, I'm pretty sure.
JJ, and we get offered politicians on a fairly regular basis. In the main, I'm not terribly interested. JJ, since the day a UHC CEO went down, thousands of Americans have died because of claim denials by health insurance companies. Does Cuomo care about them? That's fine.
I'm not negating that. I'm just saying.
That's fine. I'm just more focused on.
I agree with you.
On this small corner of the internet.
I agree with you, but your manners.
Royal with cheese. If talking with your constituents is gauche, then I want my congressperson wearing a Louis Vuitton tracksuit, gold, chains, and a Rolex. Dave from Jamaica. Thanks for this year's Cobb. Thanks for this year's coverage. And Sam for fighting Tim Pool's coverage.
Mm.
All right. Five more. Mad Max left. With all the heat coming Eric Adams' way and with how popular is, he's using Luigi Mangione as a human shield. Yeah, on some level, that's true. Aaron from Germany. A little bit off topic, but I've been reading a little bit about the Fairness Doctrine, which was scrapped by the FCC in the 80s. What's your opinion on something like the Fairness Doctrine being reinstated, regardless of the fact it probably won't be? There was an attempt to do this in the mid-aughts. Louise Slaughter, upstate congresswoman, late Louise Slaughter, had a couple of hearings on it, maybe outside of the House. It was sort of like her own personal hearings, because I'm in favor of it. It would, I would impose it more broadly than at that time. At that time, it just would have been radio. FCC has sort of limited jurisdiction. But yes, I think that would destroy a lot of business models. And I'm in favor of a lot of things, the regulations that would destroy business models, because I think if we could take money as the primary incentive out of a lot of the things in society, and I will tell you, in the 80s, in the early 80s, prior to the Fairness Doctrine, but even, you know, prior to like cable television, 70s and 80s, network news would be a loss leader. You can operate these things at not a profit. It's actually doable. And if you regulate it enough that, listen, you want the rest of the stuff that you're going to sell on your network or whatever it is, your news is going to have to be a little bit less profitable. It's going to basically be the way that you build your brand that's effective. All right. Two more or three more. Void or fraud? You think Brett Cooper's lawyer looks like an eerie female version of Ben's lawyer?
It's just a comment on her looking like Ben Shapiro.
Really cool. You won the war on Christmas, Sammy. Congrats and have a happy new year. And the final I am of 2024. Unless, of course, Emma or I hop on the YouTube channel, in which case, and turn on our I am machine, which is highly unlikely, but not impossible. Who wants to pick it?
You. Just you pick it quickly.
Emma's ready to go.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, A square. MR, great to end with an AOC interview. I hope you all have a good holiday break, and thanks for keeping up our spirits in these dark times. See you all in 2025. Bradley, Matt, Emma, great job this year. Folks, we will see you in 2025. Make sure you tune into some of our best ofs. They are great interviews. In fact, they were the best ofs of 2024. Have a happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
Happy Hanukkah.
And happy Hanukkah. Happy New Year. Happy winter solstice. Kwanzaa, whatever you celebrate. And we'll see you in about a week or so. Bye-bye.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.